Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You can go to Facebook and you type in the little search pad there, The Matthew Aaron Show. You click enter. And you can like us at the Facebook page. You can find us on Stitcher, iTunes. On iTunes, you can subscribe and leave some comments. And as always, though, as I suggest, the best place to listen to the show is thematthewaronshow.com, where you can catch up on our past 194 episodes. We're coming up on that big number, 199. And, no, I don't know, 200. I gave a wish list to Pat for 200, you know, like Dennis Haskins and Jaleel White. And
Dennis
Dennis
Haskins,
all the big names.
Was on your wish list for 200?
He was in A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Yeah, that's
right.
You saw him? Uh-huh.
Yeah, right. He was in that, yeah, that's right. We were just talking about that movie, and Dennis Haskins was in that movie. And looking rotund,
looking robust.
A few Taste Chicago beefs, would you say? Yeah, that's we would see him eat over at Montaigne's all the time.
That's right.
And oh, you didn't bring headphones today, so you're going with the
the telephone jack. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
My iPod ones aren't going to reach all the way over there.
Oh, okay.
Been out all day. I don't have my other ones.
Mikey, life. How are you?
Good. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that's good. Lee, you're good? I almost called you Steve.
Yes, I'm good, bro.
I almost called you Steve. It was close. You were just telling me about your film classes you're starting over at Tony Valley.
That's right. It's going to be called The Film Class, just The Film Class.
Is that what you're calling it?
At the WIP Theater, WIP, in Edison Park, and it's going to be starting this summer.
All right.
Once a week screenings with a discussion.
Yeah, I may go to one. I may.
That's great.
I mean, I wouldn't get crazy about it, but
No.
If you're playing a movie I care about, I may show up.
Right.
Just so I can harass the instructor afterwards.
Yeah. Well, you can harass me all you want. You'll be banished.
I'll be banished.
Get out of my class.
I'll be banished from the theater.
From the theater.
All right.
Looks great in there. He fixed up. He's got these great chairs.
Where's it at?
It's on Northwest Highway. Northwest and Oliphant.
Edison Park, where nobody goes.
Where Tony's Finer Foods is and Zia's Trattoria and all these wonderful places.
Super Dog's over there.
Well, it's close.
It's about 5-10 minutes.
5-10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know.
It's not that far. It's not that far. I mean, literally, when Mikey and I are driving back from Super Dog, we go through Edison Park, through the suburb area.
Yeah, I like Edison Park.
Yeah, it's nice.
It's a place.
Hey, idea for the 200th episode. What are the chances you could get Pat to get you Dennis Franz?
If you could go to Montana and set up a cell signal at that cave he lives in.
He lives in Montana?
Yeah, he left Chicago and moved to, he probably at this time he was New York or L.A., and he said he was done with the business, he was retired.
Oh, God.
He's moving to Montana, and he's holed up over there.
Does he have a ranch?
I would assume so.
I got to assume. I mean, I'm sure it's not one he works on.
I got 250 head of steers right over there.
Well,
I got the sheep. That's where the sheep are.
Let's be honest about something. I mean, there's about, four people per square mile in Montana? I mean, it's hard not to have a ranch.
You got
to
be pissed off at the business, dude.
Put it this way, he has at least ranch land.
Of where, of course.
Well, everyone's in Montana that I know from the business, it seems.
His ranch is next to Harrison Ford's, is next to Dennis Quaid's.
Quaid's there, Harrison's there.
It's got to be beautiful.
Andy McDowell, Missy Pyle, a lot of people.
He's almost on time.
I'm trying to think who else is in Montana that's famous. Roddy Piper's in Montana, that's right.
All right.
That's an interesting question. Who's famous that lives in Montana?
Probably a lot more people.
But there's a difference between people who live in Montana and people who have a house in Montana.
Well, yeah, that's true. And then the other thing is, how many of them are from Montana and got the hell out of there?
Right.
I'm sure there's just as many that got the hell out of Montana that went into Montana. We just traded off.
There is nothing going on there.
There's a lot.
No.
Although it is ranked the happiest state in the entire United States.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
It's probably
because they probably couldn't get a hold of anyone to vote.
well, that and that. There's probably absolutely zero government of anything.
They
out
got
there.
Into Montana. They drove to one guy's house, got his vote, and they're like, "All right, where's your neighbor? Oh, about 74 miles down to the you go east.
Yeah,
just go east.
All right, Montana's the happiest."
Montana's the happiest state, 100%. That's
state,
the vote.
State congressional meetings meet at Zelda's Diner.
Yeah, right. Well, we know there's a Dairy Queen there, thanks to Brett Cullen.
There's one thing.
That is very true.
Did he tell the Dennis Quaid story on the show, or did he tell me that in private?
No, I think we told it in
meaning,
private.
Can we tell it here or not?
No, but it's such a great story.
Yeah.
I think he told it on the show, though. He did tell it on the
gotta
show.
Love PA systems.
Yeah, yeah. Steve Burns joining us, Malcolm Freeberg from Survivor, and he's got a new show coming out. And hold on, I gotta look up I'd look up the title of it, but I've turned off my email and I've turned off my phone. And it's called The Wayfarer, though. The Wayfarer is a travel series he's doing a Kickstarter for, which my understanding is the Kickstarter started today. So basically, he wants to get the money for a pilot, I believe. We're gonna talk to him about it. And as a guy being on Survivor, he must know a thing or two about traveling. So we're going to talk to him about that. I believe the way that he wants the show to work is people would vote. He got that concept from somewhere.
Right.
Wow.
He wants people to vote on where he goes and what he does. And then I haven't seen that in a travel show, so that's fascinating.
Oh, that's good.
I'm sure there's some interesting red tape with that, though.
When you have the people vote for you what to do, how do you not? I'm gonna ask him. How do you not just? You have to scroll through a lot of like disgusting, depraved stuff that people
create.
Right. I wonder if anybody can be voted off the show.
And there is like a million. There's like a million questions I have for him about the Survivor, though, because I'm curious about the shit they don't show you on that show.
You mean the most scripted reality TV show of reality TV shows?
I want to know about that.
Yeah.
I want to know where you poop. Like, things like this are the things I want
to
know.
You know, they're not on an island. They're in the backwoods by the resort.
I heard a story. Jeff Probst has a yacht. There's a yacht for the crew and Jeff Probst. But they're legit on the island. And I've heard that story. I don't know how true it is. These are the things I want to ask. Uh-huh. These are the survivor questions
the poop
I
yacht.
Ask.
I
we
know
Jeff
poop
Probst.
Too.
We know Jeff Probst is on the yacht. He's not islanding it up.
No.
If you're not getting paid to sleep in the woods, what would you
Is he going
to
creep me out and stand up the whole time? Giuliano's I'm here. Just surprised he's leaning against some boxes.
He's even twice as creepy as usual.
I know. You know, speaking of John Waters.
Speaking of poop.
Speaking of John Waters and poop.
Yeah, I'm just surprised he's here before
there's a
9
little,
o'clock.
There's a little John Waters. John Waters would cast him in a movie. There's two directors I know that would be like, I want to put Anthony in a movie. John Waters and Gus Van Sant.
Yeah.
And Gus Van Sant, you'd be like a 50-year-old man in one of his movies. He likes him young. All right. I believe Steve Byrne's calling in. Let's see if this is Steve Byrne. Hello. Is this Steve?
This is Steve.
Ah, Steve Byrne. How you
hey,
doing,
Steve.
Pal?
Good. How you doing? Thanks for having
Sullivan,
me.
Sullivan and Sons. That's only been on a few years. You're doing okay.
I'm doing okay. I can actually spend a few weeks out of the year not packing my suitcase and going to Des Moines to eat chicken tenders. This is good.
Listen, there's something enjoyable, though, about going to Des Moines and eating chicken tenders. I kind of like that road life. Like, when I go on road trips, I kind of dig it. Now, let's talk about this, though, because you are a Chicago stand-up comic. I basically, your whole history is very fascinating to me. Your relationship with Vince Vaughn, Sullivan and Sons, this whole thing's very fascinating to me. But let's start with the basics. Tell me about your start in stand-up and the scene in Chicago at the time that you were doing it.
Well, actually, I lived in Chicago for 4 years, and that was literally up until a year ago. But I actually started stand-up in New York City. I started in 97, right out of college. I went to Kent State University in Ohio because
I
lived in Pittsburgh.
I went there for 6 months. I got expelled.
Yeah, right.
I did. I got expelled. That's true. I got three. They had, like, campus police there. And I got, like, three tickets. I got three tickets in
three
6 months, so it was see you later.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
one too many panty
raids. I'm serious. I went to Kent State as well, home of Dan Patrick and Michael Keaton.
That's right. That's still and Drew Carey. And I think Arsenio Hall went there, too.
And Steve Byrne.
And
Steve
Arsenio.
Byrne. So
and
there you go. Yeah.
I went to Kent State because my grades were so bad in Pittsburgh, I couldn't get in any schools in Pennsylvania, so I went across the border. That's how I ended up there.
Well, that makes me feel good.
But I ended up moving to New York City right out of school because my parents were living there at the time, and I said, you know, I never lived in New York. Could I just spend 3 months on your couch, experience New York? I was going to go up to California because my deal was I go to college, then I get to do whatever I want. And
yeah, right. My parents did the same, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So I crashed on the couch, and the first day I got to New York City, I walked up and down Broadway, starting at 96th Street. And I ended up down on 50th and Broadway, and I walked into Caroline's Comedy Club, and I asked if they had any job positions available. I was just going to every restaurant I could find, anything. I would do anything. And the manager happened to be standing there. He said, what do you want to do? I said, I'll do anything. He said, great, you got a job. Come back tomorrow. So I started sweeping the floors, answering the phones, and I was watching Chappelle and Margaret Cho and Jon Stewart and everybody that was on SNL at the time, Colin Quinn and Daryl Hammond, and I was watching all these stand-ups. I go, boy, that looks like fun. I'd like to try that. And after 4 months, I worked up enough courage, and I went to Stand Up New York, a club on the Upper West Side, and I tried out some stand-up, and it went really well. So I think because it went well, I had confidence to go back a second time. I think if it stunk, I might not be talking to you right now. So.
Now, Steve, did Caroline's not have an open mic, or was you weren't going to shit where you eat?
Exactly. Yeah, I wasn't going to embarrass myself. That's why I looked in front of all my coworkers.
Yeah, I kind of had a feeling. I'm like, why is he not doing Caroline's open mic? Because I'm sure they had an open mic. What a talented cast of people, though, back then in New York. I kind of feel like after that there was like Louis C.K. and guys like that, and now it started to like die down. Have you been to New York lately for the stand-up scene? What's it like?
Yeah, I'm going back to New York next week, actually. We're before the premiere of Sullivan, so we always kick our tour off in New York City. So I'll be back there. You know, I don't really know what the scene is like because I withdrew myself. When I was there for 7 years of my life, and I performed literally every night of my life, 7 days a week. You know, I do six or seven shows a night, and I was just consumed with it. So when I was there, I performed at every club, and I don't know. I really like the camaraderie. I like the unity that you find, the friendships you find with everybody you see on a nightly basis. But when I was coming up, like the older guard was Patrice O'Neill, Jim Norton, Greg Giraldo, Colin, Rich Voss, Nick DiPaolo. Yeah. Bill Burr was a little bit before me, Robert Kelly. So whenever people like, who influenced you, it's like, it's always that group of guys. I know I'm nothing like them, but I was always influenced by them, the fact that they could take anything, whether you agreed with it or disagree with it. And sometimes, like, Jim Norton has a very disgusting life, a life I would never lead. But he says, he conveys his life and his humor in such a great way. It's almost relatable, and it's really damn funny. And I was always like, if I could aspire that to get to that point one day where I could take things I'm passionate about in my life and communicate them somehow on a stage like they do, I'd be happy.
How do you get involved with those guys, though, in that group? And how did it turn out? Do you have non-successful friends from the stand-up scene back from when you do stand-up and that you're still friends with?
I'm like, sure, you know,
what was
people.
The difference between the people that made it and the people that didn't?
I you know, it's weird when you say people that make it and people that didn't, because no matter what, there's always ebbs and flows of everybody's career. You know, I was at the Comedy Store a few weeks ago. I saw Andrew Dice Clay performing the same night I was performing in front of 30 people, and he did Madison Square Garden at one point. So
yeah, right.
Even though right now at this moment in my life, I have a show that's coming back for a third season, and I have an hour special that just came out on Netflix. And it's like there's always ebbs and flows. I know that at some point I'm going to be back in the clubs being a comedian. So I think it happens to every comic. I mean, look, Seinfeld, could he go off and just do theaters the rest of his life? Of course he can. But when he's working on that material to go out and do a theater tour, he's going to be right back in the comedy clubs. So you're always going to be in front of those 30 people. It's the most humbling profession. But I'm in a third season. I still feel like I haven't made it yet. I'm still proving myself. So it's definitely a tough occupation, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, how did you balance 7 days a week and having a job, Steve? Like, how do you balance that?
Well, that was my job at the time. You know, I was making enough money as just a New York comic who would do 15-minute sets a night, and I could pay my rent doing that because I'd make the bulk of my money on the weekends. Instead of making $25 a set, then you're making $100 a set. So you could easily make rent, but at some point you got to say to yourself, am I just going to pay rent in New York City and be a New York comic, or do I want it all? And I always thought I want it all.
And that's kind of the difference between the New York scene and the Chicago scene. You could not pay rent off the Chicago scene. I don't care if you're doing seven nights a week. Liam, do you know any comics in Chicago that are making their living being a comic?
I'd be surprised if there were five.
And you can't think of one?
No.
No, in Chicago.
That still live in Chicago? No. Because
yeah, that's
it,
still
it's funny, time. When I at the time I had moved to California and I was I'd given up on Los Angeles. I came out here. I would never audition. Even if I did get an audition, I'd never get called back. So I said, the hell with it. And I would always go visit Vince Vaughn, who lived in Chicago at the time. And I'd just go over and crash at his place on Mondays and Tuesdays in between my gigs. You know, Wednesday I have to go to Cleveland or whatever. And so I would just crash here, and I loved the city. And I was starting to get serious with my girlfriend. We were thinking of moving somewhere. And Vince said, why don't you just move to Chicago? It's centrally located. You don't have any layovers. It's a great city. And I thought to myself, that I never would have even thought about that. But, yeah, I did that. So that's what I did. That's how I ended up living in Chicago for the 4 years I did. But I will say I agree with you guys. It's much more of a sketch improv, you know, second city kind of town more than it is a stand-up town at all, because I think you got Zany's and then you got the Schaumburg Improv, and that's kind of – out in the outskirts. So it is tough to make a living as a comedian in Chicago. You couldn't support yourself just doing stand-up in the city. It's impossible.
Yeah, and we'll get back to Chicago in a second, but since you brought up Vince Vaughn, I was curious, what's the story behind your guys' friendship? How did that come about? Because Vince, of course, is the executive producer of Sullivan Sons, and he's also Do you guys write Wild Wild West?
Yeah, I did the Wild West comedy tour because one of the guys had gotten sick and wasn't able to do a particular show. And I had never met Vince before, and I was friends with Ahmed Ahmed, who was in the documentary, and Ahmed recommended me. I went, did the show. I think this is in 2004, and it was one of those, like, miracle sets where everything just happened to go well. And, you know, you're sitting there, you're performing in front of Vince Vaughn, Jennifer Aniston's in the front row, you're like, please, God, let this go well. And thank God it did. And afterwards, we just started kind of catching up. The whole group went out afterwards, and we all had a great time, and the next, I think like a week later, Vince and Ahmed asked me if I wanted to go get lunch with them, and I did. And ever since then, we've been best pals. Like, the group of us, Vince, Ahmed, and Peter Billingsley, I've known these guys since I moved to L.A., and they couldn't be greater guys. I love them.
How many A Christmas Story jokes do you guys make around Peter Billingsley?
Yeah.
I would have to say not many because...
Zero?
Because
really? Come on. No references?
He said not many. It doesn't mean zero.
But that means there was one. There's been a joke.
I don't know. I think he's... You know, Pete's one of those guys. He's a really kind of quiet and to himself. He's a really private kind of guy. So it's something I know he's proud of. But I think it's one of those subjects where I don't know. Whatever you bring it up, I'm like, why don't I kind of make fun of him for it? But we never really talk about it, I guess. It's not on purpose. But
no busting balls over a Christmas story.
Apparently some people's friends are nicer than ours.
Because Mikey, yeah, right. I don't know if you know Peter Billingsley, for those that don't know. I don't know if Mikey knows. He's a big director now.
He was
couples
the
retreat and stuff. Right, he was the kid in Christmas
Story. Don't shoot your eye out,
but
kid.
Did you know he's a big director now? Right. He does a lot of Vince Vaughn's movies and other movies as well.
Didn't he do an on-stage version of Christmas Story a couple years ago that like did a tour?
I didn't know that. No. I'm sure Peter.
Yeah.
They
went to Broadway, yeah. They just went to Broadway.
So. Mikey and, up on the theater scene.
Mikey knows better than I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For all my Broadway information, I go to Mikey Terzo.
You know what? But if Steve goes from this and starts making fun of Peter because of us, because we told him to, that would be hilarious.
I would be so honored if I could help another friend bust another friend's balls.
Yeah, I was going to say, being kind of an honorary Chicagoan now, Steve, don't you bust your friend's balls? Haven't you learned that that's like the Chicagoan thing to do?
Oh, I mean, as a comedian, I've heard it all. I would show up at the Comedy Cellar in New York City, and I'd be called Lego head hair. just some of the most creative insults. There was a time where I always grew out my facial hair, and Jim Norton said, that's my AIDS beard. It was just always nonstop. So, I'm used to it. And it's what we do on set all day long. I mean, the four guys, we just constantly bust each other's chops when we go on tour.
Jim Norton, your one-stop shop.
Yeah.
For good AIDS humor, your one-stop shop's Jim Norton. You know what? And you performed with one of the guys who I think is a king right now, and I've been lucky enough to meet him and hang out with him, and I think he's just the best. Is Russell Peters? I mean, how awesome is Russell Peters?
He's like one of those guys where it's like it's so weird because he sells out arenas. And he's just like the most normal, cool kind of dude. We did a tour together called called the New Majority Tour, and it was with Lisa Lampanelli, Russell Peters, Gabriel Iglesias, and myself. And
no
I think we did like four.
On that tour.
Yeah, right.
No ball busting.
Yeah,
on
right.
That tour.
Not at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Lampanelli was very demure and such a lady on that tour. It was awesome. And Russell, you know, he's a guy that. I think when people go, you go to his shows and he literally can just do crowd work and somebody could be like, I'm from Sri Lanka. He'll have like a Sri Lankan joke. It's like, I might have a Cleveland joke and a Florida joke if I'm lucky, but I mean, this guy is global. He knows something about every country, no matter how small it is. And that's a great skill to have, to be able to walk into any room and be able to jump into any conversation and have a joke about whatever part of the world these people are from. It's unbelievable. I've never seen such a diverse, eclectic, global community that shows up at his shows.
When did you know you made it, Steve? Like, what was that moment for you where, like, this is working out?
Believe me, I still haven't had that moment.
Come on. He's waiting to get a call from Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah, right. Jerry Seinfeld's got to ask him the coffee, right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. As he selects one of his 50 Porsches in his own parking garage, and I go to meet him in a Dodge.
Hey. I hear you there.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's one of those things where I've had, you know, I just had a special on Netflix just come out a few weeks ago. I have a third, third season of Sullivan coming out, and I still feel like, you know, I'm not necessarily a household name. I'm one of those people that people are like, I know you from somewhere, especially in airports or restaurants. It's like, I know you. And then that's always uncomfortable because it's like, what am I going to say? Am I going to say, you know me from stand-up comedy? They go, no, that's not it. It's like, well, now I just insult myself.
I know you're from somewhere is good because that means people aren't bugging you.
Yeah, right. It's the perfect kind of fame. You've got the perfect fame right now.
I'd love to have I know you're from somewhere.
No paparazzi.
Well,
you make decent money, and no one knows who the fuck you are.
You could be the guy from high school with Raytheon. You could be that guy. It's like I could list all my credits. Like, no, you have guys in high school. I remember you. You're Steve Byrne. So I don't know. It's just, you know, it's almost there. I feel like I'm almost there.
You should just scramble somebody's brain next time they do that and be like, oh, I remember you too, and then just come up with some crazy story.
I'll tell you why.
Oh, my God, I love him. It's David Byrne.
You know why everyone loves David Byrne? I mean, Steve Byrne here. Listen, you have the market cornered. I'm half Korean, half Irish dudes. I'm just going to let you know right now. You got the market corner.
It is my speciality.
Well, you know, Irish like cabbage, Koreans like cabbage.
Yeah, right.
Cabbage.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Steve.
What's that? Go ahead. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, I was going to ask you if you just ever had any casting slips come in that are like, we're looking for a half Korean, half Irish guy.
No, that's why I had to write the show, because I was never getting cast in anything. Vince goes, you know, Vince Vaughn said you should write something, because unless they come up with a Riverdance Taekwondo movie, you're kind of out of luck, kid. So, now, after the third season, now I think I'm going to write it.
Now, yeah, right. Now, Steve, did you make sure that they couldn't find another guy? In the script, did you go, and the lead is half Korean, half Irish?
Yeah,
just so the studio execs weren't like, well, we like Steve's script, but who else do we got that's half Korean, half Irish?
Well, I certainly hope I cornered the market on that. I think they got the clue when they named the character Steve's.
So, I mean,
I'll suck if another guy turned up that was exactly like him.
The reason I brought it up is that pilot going on right now with LD Entertainment.
Right, right.
And in the pilot I wrote, the description of the lead character is crazily similar to me. I don't know how detailed it could get, but I'm like, I'm going to make sure they can't find some other fucking Chicago guy to fill this role.
You should even write a fake picture that has a little red shirt with a little thing that says, I want to be hero or something.
Oh,
like,
I put in, like, he's 5'7", 157.4 pounds. And it'll change the day I weigh myself
waistline,
again.
Waistline, holding on to what little hair there is, but holding it strong.
But let's talk about that, because I'm going through the development process with the studio right now, Steve. What was developing Sullivan and Sons like? Okay, Vince Vaughn says, write something for yourself. You write Sullivan and Sons,
yes.
You bring it to them. Tell us how this process goes from there.
Well, I don't think he ever thought I would write it. I think he was just being a supportive friend, like, hey, write something. And then, like, 6 months later, I wrote something. He's like, holy shit, okay, you actually wrote it. So I think what happens then after we did that was we wrote it. I met with a bunch of different showrunners. That was the next step, and Rob Long was one of the first guys we met, and Rob and I just gelled instantly. We had the same sense of humor, and so he and I sat down and really kind of broke down the foundation of the show, and we worked on the script for another 6 months together. So the whole thing was like a year-long process, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I know how that is. Yeah,
it takes a long time to figure out, you know, point A to point B, and unless you're on Lost, because, like, that show, now that I did a show, I don't think they had any idea how they were going to end that show, because they're like, we're going to have a smoke monster, we're going to put a polar bear.
No, and listen, I totally get it because I'm going through the same thing right now. And I feel like, Steve, with like newbies like you and I, isn't it kind of shocking how much they put in our ball court when we're putting together our first show? You're putting together your first show. Did you ever realize how much decision-making you'd actually have? You're probably like, wait, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Neither do
– Oh, totally. I'll tell you, this is how messed up Hollywood is. If I had to exemplify everything in just one little nugget, this is how messed up this town is, okay? So I live in L.A. for quite a few years, never got a call back at an audition. I was horrible at auditioning. I couldn't get cast in anything. So I write this thing. We sell the script. They say, okay, we're going to make the show. Now you got to cast the show. So I sit in on the casting sessions. I'm watching videotape of people auditioning for the show. They go, what do you think? What do you think about this person? What do you think about this person? I go, what do I think? I think I have no idea what I'm talking about. You guys should put me behind that, in front of that camera and see if I can do this, because I don't even know if I can act in my own thing that I wrote. So that's how scary it is that someone who's never gotten a role in anything can be there and judging and telling them, okay, I like this person, I like that person. It's the most crazy process.
I haven't gotten to that point yet, but, like, I know it's coming. And, yesterday I'm on a phone call with the studio executive, Steve, and they're asking me all these questions like I'm the boss. And I'm like, I don't fucking know. Why are you asking me? I don't have a fucking clue. I mean, did you ever feel like you were swimming in the deep end when you didn't know how to swim yet when you were doing this show, putting it together?
Well, I think the only time I really felt like I was in the deep end was when I was actually – reading the lines and rehearsing, you know, because first day when it all kind of culminates and it's actually happening and you're on the stage and you see it all happening in front of your face, everything that you had visualized or dreamt of or the jokes you were writing, they're being spoken by veteran actors like Dan Lurie and Brian Doyle Murray and Christine Ebersole, who are both Chicago folks, and Jody Long and all these great actors and your friends. That's when I felt like, oh boy, I'm really in the thick of this. I better come through because, again, I'd never done anything before. So if somebody had set up a camera on the stage on our off days, it would have looked like one of those Paranormal Activity videos where somebody's just standing there for hours and you see the time elapse, because I was sitting there literally reading my lines to myself, doing my blocking on the stage. It would have looked like a crazy person, but I was so scared that I had to get this right, and I didn't want to hold anybody up, so it was nuts.
You're open the door. Open the door. Open the door.
Okay, yeah.
More.
Now.
Yeah, I mean, I was always used to getting one line and be like, my lord, he is dead, or something like that, or would you like more coffee with that, and then you're out of the scene.
Yeah, what I was going to ask you was, when you set up this show, was it originally set up at TBS, or did you guys set it up and shop it around?
Well, you know, what you do is you write a script, and you go out to the networks, and you pitch it. And you see who garners any interest. And when we went
How'd your pitches go?
Because we didn't do that.
I'm fascinated by the pitching process too, because I'm going to have to do that. And everyone just tries to tell you what the perfect pitch is, and they're all different.
Yeah.
Everyone I've gotten advice from just says, "Oh, this is how you pitch," and it's different every person you talk to.
Right? Because nobody.
I say the best way to learn how to pitch after having been through the process is watching Shark Tank. I know it's a weird analogy, but that can communicate everything within 2 or 3 minutes, that's the best way to do it.
Okay, I kind of can see what you're talking about there. It's a little better than when I went to Comedy Central and they said, "So what's your favorite show on the network?" And Gary Mann said to me, and I go, "Oh, I don't watch the network." That's how you pitch, baby.
Yeah.
That's how you pitch. When I told him, I don't watch your damn network.
I've never seen your show. Is it good?
I seriously told him.
You know.
And then he told me that they were making TV for 15 to 18-year-old potheads. And I go, well, you should get one of them to write a show for you.
Yeah.
Dummy.
Yeah, really.
As the executives say, and no, we don't validate your parking. Have a good day.
Right. Right.
You were the man who knew too little.
That was literally the worst pitch session of all time. I think I bombed.
I'll tell you,
that's hilarious.
We went to one network. I forget what's in. I know what network. I'm not going to say the network. Yeah,
right.
But
you're not as dumb as me to throw Gary Mann's name out there.
Well, kind of like Fox, but they're missing an O in the middle.
Yeah, right.
We walked in, and it literally was like being on a first date, and you farted as soon as you sat down at the table for dinner. It was like, well, this date's over. We should just get up. We shouldn't even order. I mean, this is bad. They're just staring at you.
What happened that was so bad?
I think that we were there, to be honest with you.
Now,
because
was
it was
Vince
funny.
With you? Was Vince Vaughn pitching with you, or he just put his name on it? Go to town, Steve.
He was with you.
He didn't leave you
out to dry.
So even with Vince in the room, Lifetime Network, Women's Television, wherever you were at, they were like, yeah, no, right. This is not happening.
No.
It was one of the major networks, but we walked in, and it could not have been less well-received. I mean, from the minute we walked in, it was funny because as we were walking in, there was another famous actress walking out, and they were hugging and kissing, and can't wait to work on this with you. It's going to be great. We're thinking, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, she's
got
a deal
going.
And,
today.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, I'm thinking, all right. Get a load of this guy. Look who's to my left. And we go strolling in, and it was just death.
I'm trying to pitch a show about comedians and their sexual escapades, and like, sir, this is Nat Geo.
Yeah, right. I got to tell you, though, and by the way, so everyone knows, Sullivan and Son starts, the new episode starts June 24th again on TBS, 10-9 Central. And you guys are coming as a crew on tour, you and the boys like Owen Benjamin and Ahmed. You guys are coming to the Chicago Improv, the 8th through the 10th, is that correct?
Yeah, we'll be out there, and I will be at the Chicago Improv, or I will be at Portillo's.
I'll be at Portillo's. I'll see you there.
Yeah.
No, I'm gonna come by one of your shows and say hi. That's what I'm gonna do. Are you available to say hi? Can people bug you, or are you gonna go hide out after the show? You're like, yeah, I'll sign off.
When I'm at that Chicago Improv, it's right next to it's in that mall, in the Schaumburg Mall.
Woodfield.
So
yeah, right.
It's
right.
At Woodfield.
Yeah, that's again where I get confused.
We don't need. I was going to say, Steve, let's go for a bite at Pei Wang, and I'll take you to Lids afterwards.
And then we'll stop at the Drink Nightclub and really Schaumburg it up.
Yeah, right.
Well, my goal is always this. I always say to my agents, book me as close as you can to Elaine Bryant. Please make that happen.
That's good.
Yep.
That's good. And Champion, which is your new comedy special that you were speaking of, it's on Netflix, iTunes, the whole shebang there. Amazon, I believe.
Yeah.
I could be wrong about the Amazonians. But I could be wrong about that. But, I mean, this Sullivan and Sons, let me tell you why I love this show. First of all, you are absolutely a standout talent. But more importantly, you had the brains to say, I want Dan Loria. And I want Brian Doyle Murray. And I want Christine Ebersole. And I'm like, boy, that's a really good cast of actors.
Yeah, really.
That's a really good cast of actors for supposedly these cable show sitcoms that they give you no budget for.
Right.
That's a pretty good group.
Outstanding.
I mean, we definitely lucked out. It's like when you it's like my job really, you know, I'm a straight man on my own show. But we consciously did that because I'm either going to be the same man in an insane world or vice versa. And I thought, well, you get a lot more mileage if you could have a bigger ensemble cast that's a lot more crazy to spread around. So when you have this ensemble, it's great because then you see, like, look, Christine Ebersole, Brian Doyle Murray, Jodie Long. I mean, it's just like you throw them a slow pitch, and they are knocking it out of the park every time in rehearsal, at the table read there. It's almost like the only way to compare it is whenever you're driving and you're trying to sing along to Frank Sinatra, and you realize, wow, I really can't sing. That's what it's like working with them.
Well,
they're
amazing.
I'm not as bad at
with
Frank
that analogy,
as I am to Dean Martin. Dean Martin's
analogy,
where I'm no good. Dean Martin's the best.
When you sing with them in the background, you sound better.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
I think we can carry
it. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, I think in a funny way that's good, though, because Steve was talking about how, like, look, you know, he's the lead of the show, and all his roles previous to this, he had, like, the one-line guy. He was the one-line guy, these pretzels are making me thirsty guy.
Yeah.
And then I think it's smart to surround yourself with Dan Loria, Christine Ebersole, and Brian Doyle Murray, because if you stink, Steve Byrne, it'll cover it up.
Well,
they cover up the stink in the room.
Yeah, that is correct.
He said to them, I want Christine and Dan and Jody and BDM, and they were like, okay.
Right.
That said, okay, sure, we'll put Wayne Knight somewhere else.
Yeah,
or whatever they said.
How did How did you get this cast, Steve? Because you talked about how involved in the casting process you were. Does Dan
Lurie
got to audition, or are you like, dude, this is the fucking dad from the Wonder Years? He's not auditioning. Like, this is the guy
the last episode
of the Wonder Years. We're all crying when it's like dad died 4 years ago. And you're in, like, tears because Fred Savage just broke your heart.
that's all very true, yeah. Well, you know, it's crazy because when you are casting, you know, for those parts, you're not really auditioning. You're basically meeting with them and seeing, you're kind of gauging their interest in the script and in the project, seeing if they've even read the script. But it's kind of funny. Vince was in New York City and saw Dan Lurie on Broadway doing Lombardi. So we just happened to luck out that Vince had suggested Dan Lurie. And we said, absolutely, that's a great name. So we met Dan, and as soon as he left the room, I just looked at Pete and said, that's my father. I mean, he is just like my dad. So we put the offer out to him, and I think within the hour, Dan got back and said, yeah, he'd love to do it. And same with Brian Doyle Murray. Brian Doyle came in. We sat down with him, loved it. Christine, we just offered it to her because, I mean, the woman's got 2 Tony Awards. She was on SNL. She was actually on SNL when Brian Doyle Murray was on SNL. So, so that was a no-brainer.
I was going to say, how would you feel if you're Dan Lurie and you had to audition in front of Steve fucking Byrne? You're like,
I
got to audition in front of Steve Byrne. I'm just busting your butt.
Yeah. He'd be on suicide watch, I think.
Feel. I'm like, I'm going to have to audition people for the pilot? Why? Who the fuck am I?
Ray Liotta, you would feel like that.
Come in here and deliver your lines for Matthew Aaron.
What do you think, Steve? Well, he was good.
Yeah, right.
I thought he was good.
Yeah, he was good. Yeah.
I don't know. Tell him we'll call him back.
Yeah, could you imagine, like, you're Steve Byrne and you got to give critical notes on Dan Lurie's performance? Listen, here's how I feel about Dan's work right now.
Yeah.
A little too much Meisner.
Yeah.
That's how I still feel to this day.
So
a little methody for my taste.
Got to imagine this set's really a close-knit unit. I mean, you guys are fucking traveling together doing stand-up, for God's sakes. And by the way, what a who's who of stand-up comedians you got on the show with you, too. I mean, how did you get all these guys together to fit under one budget?
Desperation, probably, on their part. I just think that those are all guys that I'd seen, you know, in the clubs over the years, and Ahmed was one of the first guys I met, so that's how he got written in. But Owen and Roy, I met more or less always doing stand-up and getting to know them from being at the Hollywood Improv or the Comedy Store. I just thought, boy, they're damn funny. And if I ever, when I was writing it, I was like, these are types of guys I would like to see in the show because they're the kind of guys, like, if they were performing, I'd go sit in the back of the club and actually watch their set. And we just lucked out. I think Roy Wood is one of the funniest guys working right now, but he is somebody for some reason or another that isn't like on Comedy Central's radar, and I think it's so ridiculous that they really are skewed towards this alternative, you know, grow your beard out, act like you don't care. But it's like Roy is a true comedian. I'd put him up there with anybody else that's working out right now. I think he's the funniest one on our tour, to be honest with you.
Yeah, Roy Wood Jr., yeah. I mean, there's a lot of great people on this show. You know, I was going to ask you a question. I don't know, because you lived in Chicago for 4 years. I always hear, and you've worked with all these guys, Vince Vaughn, Jeremy Piven. You've worked with a lot of Chicago people. And there's always these stories that go around about, because I remember when I was in L.A., everyone I would meet's like, oh, you're from Chicago. Like, and they give you, like, these stories or they give you attitude like everyone from Chicago is a jerk.
Right.
Why did you ever figure out where that comes from and what impression you get from that? Have you ever heard that?
Or is it merely just true?
Yeah, or is it merely true? Right. Or are we all?
I don't think it's merely just true. I think it's the fact that everybody in Los Angeles, you know, is there's a sense of entitlement buried deep down inside them, but they act as though they really care, they're really glad to meet you or whatever, because you never know who's going to be able to help you out. I think Chicago, I think New York are very similar in the fact that it's just like, what do you want? I got stuff to do. Move. You're in my way. I think there's a real honesty in folks
here
that are from Chicago. Chicago really represents the best of the Midwest to me, and I've always considered myself a Midwestern kind of guy with you know, blue-collar values and a Midwestern mindset, you know, being able to say please and thank you, which is few and far between out here in this city. So I've always loved Chicago. That's why I moved there.
Yeah. Now you said you were in Chicago. You're not here anymore?
No, when we got picked up for a third season, that's when I said to myself and my wife and I had a conversation. It's just like it's just too much to go back and forth and ping pong and leave our place alone for 6 months, because we had done that the two previous seasons. So this third one, we sold our place. And I actually lived in Bucktown, right by the Blue Line, so it was easy. I was always able to jump on the train to go to O'Hare, but now yeah. I live in California where there's traffic everywhere.
That's where I live too. I was right by that Damon Blue Line. That was my spot.
Do you mind me asking, like, what area, LA? Are you a Valley guy, or are you a Hollywood
this
guy?
This is a side fascination of ours.
It is.
Well, I live in Pasadena, and Pasadena is far enough away from everything that you don't feel like you're in Los Angeles.
Steve Byrne
I knew
guy.
I love Steve.
I knew I was a Steve Byrne guy.
Pasadena's
the place to be, pal.
California's Evanston.
I got to tell you, he's right. I got to tell you, Steve, I knew I liked you, pal. I knew I liked you. That is my favorite place.
Thank you.
Good night, that, Steve.
Yeah. Have you been to the burger joint yet with the bar in the basement with all the pool tables? What's it called?
Oh, God. Wait, I think Vince took me there, actually.
Yeah, the burgers. Of course
he did. Vince
He knows
there.
Where the Midwest bars are at.
You know what? I got to give it up for Vince. Vince
That's
goes
funny,
where the
yeah.
folks go. He goes where the folks go.
He really ends up at every place I've ever been.
Yeah, he was.
And I kind of hate him.
Yeah, I did. When I used to see him at the Pontiac Cafe before it became a taco place on Damon right by the L Stop, and he was at the bar, and he was yelling out, "Who do I have to fuck to get a drink here?" That was what he was.
I feel like this goes one of two ways.
Classic.
We would either be best friends with the Steve Byrne, Vince Vaughn group, or we'd be the alternate universe group that they hate. We'd walk up to each other and be like Superman meets Bizarro Superman, and it just wouldn't go over. I don't know which way
it'd be
it
like
would.
Two news teams and Anchorman.
Right. No, that's great though, Pasadena. See, you get away from that LA bullshit over there.
Yeah,
it's like it's actually like the neighbors say hi to each other. You can leave your doors unlocked here. It's like tree-lined streets where you feel like you're anywhere in America. Otherwise, you know, you're out there in the thick of it in like West Hollywood or, you know, I can't stand it.
No, me either. And there's also this great breakfast burrito you could get in Pasadena. But I'll tell you right now, the old Greek man that owns the joint is not the friendliest man you're ever going to come in contact with.
I love that we're bringing up Lucky Boy.
Lucky Boy, that's right. Lucky Boy. Lucky Boy, it's in Pasadena. It's open to like 2 or 3 a.m.
It's a late-night diner run by what I think is probably Southern California's only Greek guy.
Yeah, right.
And he makes this mean breakfast burrito that he hates making.
But if you ask for, like, sauce for it, Lee and I asked for sauce, and he goes, "You want sauce?
You want sauce? Hey, Malacca.
Steve, I got to ask you, now that you're out there in L.A., you know, being in Chicago for 4 years, what do you miss about Chicago being out there in L.A.?
You know, I will be completely honest. This sounds really weird, but because I've been watching so much playoff hockey, the one thing I miss is the national anthem at the United Center. I've never, to this day, heard anything like that in my life. Because, you know, I know it sounds cheap, but it sounds a little, you know, nostalgic, but I've always prided myself on the fact that I try to do at least a USO tour every year and be supportive of the military, and I'm actually one of the people I think that lives in this city that's proud of their country, and to hear, you know, that whole sold out madhouse on Madison, like hear everybody sing the national anthem at their lungs and clap and scream and cheer, there was a euphoria in that I've never seen at a sporting event. And I remember it took me about 6 or 7 games to actually kind of not be numb to it, but to almost be used to it, because I used to kind of well up the first few times I heard it. I was like, I've never seen this in my life. So that to me was really, really kind of blew me away, and it still does to this day. There's times where I was watching the playoffs, and they would show it actually on NBC Sports Network, the national anthem, and I still get chills to this day when I watch that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, they don't quite get into it quite as much in LA King games.
No, it's great. I'm so glad you did the show, Steve. And we want to come out and see you when you're at the Improv, which is the 8th through the 10th in Chicago here. The new season of Sullivan Sons is June 24th on TBS, 9 Central, 10 Eastern if you're one of those kind of people. And he's at the Gotham Comedy Club on June 18th there in New York City. And you can watch Champion Steve stand-up special. If you're a stand-up kind of person, Netflix, iTunes, etc., you're going to do no better. Steve, I'm so happy you did the show. Is there any future? Do you got any movies or anything you're doing, or is it just Sullivan & Sons right now?
Well, Sullivan & Sons, I'm going to start writing my fourth hour special and start touring with that. But, I wrote a script with two of my buddies that wrote on the show, and we just turned that in. So we'll see what happens with that. Maybe that can come to fruition. But at the end of the day, I got to thank you guys, because sometimes doing press like this is not all that much fun, but you guys made me a little nostalgic, and I can't wait to get back to Chicago. So thank you guys very much. And when we're down there, definitely let's hang.
I'll tell you what, Steve, I'm going to bring you some Portillo's.
We're doing that, yeah.
You don't need that good. August 8th night because you're going to eat anyways because you're going to think this kid's full of shit and you're going to forget about me anyways.
Yeah.
But I'm going to show up August 8th.
When we show up with
now, how do you like your beef, Steve? How you like it? Dipped, wet, hot? Sweet. What are we talking here?
I'll tell you what my favorite kind of is. My favorite kind is free. So anything you bring, I'll be happy with.
All okay, right. Sweet's fine. Okay, sweet's good. Mikey, sweet. Did you write this down?
I got it. We're not.
We're coming out to see you, pal. August 8th through the 10th at the Improv, and we'll meet you at Lids. And
we should bring him a Johnny's beef.
Oh, a Johnny's beef.
Yeah.
Oh, have you had Johnny's beef, Steve?
Oh yeah, I hit most of them. We always used to go to Al's over by the 9094 where you jump on the highway.
Who made you do that?
Downtown.
Is that Vaughn?
Yeah.
Do I gotta hunt this guy down? He likes Al's. Al?
Vince and I need to have a talk.
Yeah. Right. You have a talk with him. All right.
Okay. Hey, Vince, right. Come sit down over here.
We'll come see you, Steve. We'll have a good time. I don't think Johnny's is going to travel well to Schaumburg, is my point.
No,
in Schaumburg.
Yeah, right.
We don't even have to go to the city.
They call it the Chicago Improv, but it's at the Schaumburg.
Steve, you're the best. I don't even have to go to the city.
Yeah, they love that.
Yeah, it's the Chicago Improv for people that can't afford to live in downtown Chicago.
Yeah, right.
Well,
exactly.
As we like to call it around here, Schaum Vegas. They get off on that stuff.
Yeah, Schaum Vegas.
Schaum Wow.
That's so funny.
Thank you.
Well, I definitely appreciate it. Good luck to you on your pilot.
Yeah, thank you, pal. We'll see if it ever gets made. You never know. That's my attitude on life.
God, we're
we'll
fucked.
See.
We'll see.
We're fucked. Thanks, Steve.
All right, guys. Take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
He was good.
He was great.
Steve Burns, great. Yeah, that's a winner right there.
We've had quite a few back-to-back quality interviews on the
show. Yeah, we have. Pat, when's Malcolm coming on?
Let us know.
Pat.
He's coming.
Pat.
Did you even? All right.
Listen, Vince Vaughn eats at Al's. We need to have a talk. This is...
Especially, he doesn't even go to the one on Taylor.
This is serious.
Yeah, at least go to the one on Taylor.
9094?
Go across the street and get your Italian ice.
The one, 9094, that's the one... Is he talking about the one on Ohio?
He's talking about...
The one across from Old Geno's?
No, not that one.
Where Geno's used to be?
Oh, no.
Which one's he talking about?
They're building. They built other stores.
There's like 30 of them.
Yeah. No, yeah, but he said the one off 9094, and you got to imagine Vince is in the Gold Coast. So I'm guessing it's
the
one
off
Ohio.
Yeah, well, that's...
Literally right there.
That's not a good one
either. Ontario.
There is a good one. There's a good Al's, Mike.
The one on Taylor. Well, here's the thing.
Okay.
The one on Taylor, if you notice it, the one on Taylor's got a red awning and all the other ones are all yellow.
Yeah.
That's because it kind of turned into the Uno's thing, where the guy sold their naming right, but they didn't really do much with the recipe.
No, they did. Well, the Uno's went downhill. When's the last time you were there?
You're right. Uno's and Dewey's in the city is
terrible. Chucky and I went to Uno's like 4 years ago. And it was awful.
Awful.
It's not even okay. Not even like average awful.
Shockingly bad.
I remember going to Uno's 10 years ago as a kid.
Greasiest fucking pizza you'll ever have.
I remember going 10 years ago as a kid, and it was, I thought, as good or maybe even better than Lou Malnati's.
Oh, it was the best.
And you're right. I went there like 3-4 years ago.
I went when I was little.
It was almost as bad as the chain location.
I'll tell you the worst thing about Uno's on the planet is Chuck and I's experience a couple years ago is, you go there on a Saturday, you got to wait like 40 minutes to get seated.
Yeah.
But you can put in your pie order. So you're like, it takes 30, 40 minutes to make a deep dish. So
you sit, eat, and you get the...
Yeah, right. We'll go outside, smoke for 40 minutes, or I will smoke for 40 minutes, and by the time we get called in, our pie's ready, we're eating, and we're out. We ordered. We got seated 40 minutes later. It still took another 20 minutes for our pie, 20, 25 minutes. It comes out. It's this greasy, burnt, like, disgusting fucking thing. We cut in it. It's one of those deep dish pies when you cut into it. It's so greasy. You just see, like, this watery grease, like, fall off it to
but
the side.
But that's the problem I had with Lou's, though, is that it was basically soupy. I always tell them
which
to do it.
Which Lou's? It depends where you go.
Not all Lou's are created equal.
Well,
yeah.
We went to Lou's Lincoln. Lou's in Lincolnwood, because that's where I lived.
Really?
And
Lincoln
that's the original one?
Yeah,
yeah.
The Lincolnwood one?
But soupy. I'm telling you, that was the word
I
would describe.
I believe you.
Maybe
so. What you're talking about, like when the sauce, like we had at Michael Anthony's last
week. Like it wasn't
week.
Made,
soupy.
Like it was merely unfrozen.
We went to Michael Anthony's last week.
If you got
week.
It well done, it was okay.
I think somebody messed up on your pizza. Nah.
Well, I think someone messed up on ours at Michael Anthony's.
For 15 years?
It's been that way all the time?
I don't know.
Well, I've been eating Lou's. I've never actually been to Lincoln Lou. I've been to Elk Grove, Schaumburg a million times.
Yeah.
I've never.
Here's my judgment on these kind of places. Have you ever had bad Lou's twice in a row?
No.
Never. Right. Have you had bad Al's twice in a row? Oh, yeah.
Have I had bad Al's five times in a row?
Yeah, that streak goes. I can't believe Vince Vaughn eats at Al's. Come on. Yeah. That's so true.
Yeah, it is because he's Polish.
So true. That's so
oh, wait,
true.
You didn't want people to hear that.
That's really true, though. It's really true. He don't know
and if you notice,
Italian beef.
He's from the North Shore.
He is from the North Shore.
Yep.
North. You know, those North Shore guys that come
you
down.
You know what,
think
though?
You think he's going to drive all the way to Johnny's?
Caesar speculates it's the one on Madison by the United Center, which if that's the case, that's why he eats there.
It's terrible, too.
Because he goes there all the
he
time
goes there
for the
see,
hall.
You know what?
Game, yeah.
You don't even,
oh, that one's terrible.
Screw
one
Johnny's. Go to Joe Boston's Beef.
Yeah, Joe Boston's off of Sacramento. Way better.
Oh, my God.
Way better.
And you
Sacramento
know what?
And Chicago.
It's been there forever.
Yeah,
and
no,
you,
it's
and
been there
forever.
And if
you go to that Ohio L,
Joe
why don't
Boston,
just go to Mr. Beef? You're
Mikey and I have been talking about Joe Boston's for a few weeks. We've been meaning to go.
Maddie, I want to go there so bad. If they were open late, I'd drive there right now tonight.
Oh, me too. I'm with you. We were talking about when we went to Gene and Jude's that one night. We had to drive through like 400 trains.
But I think Bob... And drive through the gates in one of them.
Oh yeah, we had to drive through the gates. It was we couldn't get to our Gene and Jude's in time.
I'm looking up to see what time they close right now.
They're closed.
Joe Boston's.
The Joe Boston's closes at 9. I want.
I think it's
early.
I think it's 9 or 10.
It's early.
Shit.
But Joe Boston's, no joke. It's the top three in Chicago. It's in the top three.
And you know
beef,
what?
Of beef.
Up until like the last 2 or 3 years. Nobody heard of it.
You
could
really?
Ask, you could ask. Oh, Maddie, I remember when my uncle in Elmwood Park was the one who took me there first time when I was like 12 years old.
Yeah.
And then I went there like one other time with my dad, and then once I got my license at 18, I went back because I tried to find it, and I went to Jimmy's over on Grand and Pulaski. And Jimmy's and Joe Boston's were like the two hot dog and beef stands that when I was like 18, 19 years old, I didn't know anybody who knew about those spots. Everybody,
really?
Even people were like, oh, Gene and Jude's and Johnny's. They didn't even know about Joe Boston.
Yeah,
Joe Boston.
That's true.
You know what? I didn't know about Joe Boston until like 2005, 2006, when I did some hardcore research on Italian beefs. That's when I really got into the beef scene, was probably like, I'm serious. I mean, it's funny to think about the beef scene.
When I was a young beef scene.
Yeah, right. Well, but in like 2005, I started. That's when I ate at Carmi's and Chickie's.
Right.
And Mikey and I, we were talking about all these
Carmi's
places.
Carmi's was great.
We were talking about Carmi's that closed down, and I didn't know it closed down. It closed down, I think, while we were in L.A. and a few other places. And, I mean, this is where I was. I would eat at all these places. I went to Joe Boston's, and I'll never forget. Joe Boston's was like, wow, I don't want to come to this neighborhood ever again, but this beef's amazing.
Well, you know what's crazy is that, you know, that neighborhood 10 years ago we used to go was real bad.
You're right.
And Joe Boston has been there so long, it's watched that neighborhood go from being nice and Italian to extremely Puerto Rican.
Oh, no, you could do one of those movie montages where you're driving through the neighborhood and they're playing, like, Snoop Dogg, Gin and Juice.
Yeah, right.
And then it, like, transitions into, like, some MGMT song or something.
Yeah, right.
Or Arcadia Fire or whatever.
And now it's turning into hipster.
That's what I'm saying.
So,
yeah, right.
I'm sure.
Parson.
I'm sure in the next 2 to 3 years, it'll be the hipster heaven.
I'm sorry. Parsons Chicken, I'm tired of hearing about it. It's average. I hate doing this. I hate because they seem like nice people. Mikey and I, the service there was
from
amazing.
From Gin and Juice to Gin and
service
Juice.
We met one of the managers. He was the nicest guy. I hate
you can,
doing this.
You
I
can,
hate burying right. the place.
You can tell they're using great ingredients.
People are blowing this place so hard. I just got to say, Parsons is not the best fried chicken in Chicago. It's
no.
not even in the top five.
No. Harold's Chicken Shack.
Harold blows
Ooh.
It
It doesn't even have to be one of the good Harold locations.
No.
It could be any of them.
No. Well, I've had some. The Harold's,
you know what?
The Harold's in Bucktown is lousy. I'm sorry. And the Harold's
the
on, Washington, on Washington. On Washington by my store is not is okay.
I'm the one that just opened.
Well, they got under
they
new
management. Right.
Well, no, they're under new management because the last
have
one they
tried
ran
it?
Like a shithole.
Have
yes,
you tried it?
It was good. It was not great.
The
it's
best,
still not better than Delray's. Sorry.
Oh, Delray's is the best.
The king.
Outgrades Delray's.
Is good. I will tell you this, though. I will tell you this. The best Harold's I've been to at least, off the top of my head, at least 11 different Harold's Chicken. I've been to one in Western. I've been to the one in Bucktown. I've been to three on the south side of Chicago.
The south side locations, I imagine, are better.
They are
the
better.
The Indiana one's got to be okay.
Never
yeah.
been to the Indiana one. Went to one in Joliet. Went to one in Aurora.
There's one on Clybourne and Fullerton.
You're right. You're right. There's one. Long story short, the best one out there that I've ever been to. And it's so good that every time, and it's like one of the shittiest looking ones.
Yeah, right.
But the best one out there is on 87th and Halstead. And you go there, and it's like.
Really?
Yes. You go there, and.
That's not far from, what town would that be?
It's Chicago.
Is it still Chicago?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but that's got to be like really close.
That's
to
Roseland.
Like, Roseland, yeah.
It's a great neighborhood.
That's where my dad grew up.
Yeah.
In that neighborhood.
So, but yeah, you go to 87th.
A little different
Halstead.
Now. It's a little
that
different
chicken,
now.
It's so good. You get back to your car, and you bite into that chicken, and it just like it's like an orgasm in your mouth.
Really?
It's so good.
That oh, good, huh?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Wow. You're right, Roseland. That's that area right there, yeah. Yeah, you're literally like 2 minutes from
so where I used to go door-to-door selling cable. That's how I found the place.
Hold on. I'm hoping this is Malcolm coming in, calling in, and not some crazy fried chicken fanatic who's going to burn me for saying person sucks. Malcolm, is this you?
I forgot all about
it. How dare you talk about fried chicken that way?
Malcolm Friedberg. Speaking
this
of...
is Malcolm. I don't even know what happened with fried chicken. I just heard that as I was calling in.
Survivor Zone. Speaking of traveling, speaking of all this, let's talk about the Wayfarer. Let's talk about Survivor. I got a million Survivor questions to ask you because I whenever I've seen the show, my questions are always the stuff that's not on TV. So I want to talk about that. And then but let's talk about the Wayfarer. Let's talk about your Kickstarter campaign. You were putting together a show for the Travel Channel. Is that the goal here?
What we're doing is hosting it all ourselves online. It plays really into the theme of the show. We have our own website, Wayfaring Live. And it's a 20-day road trip around the United States. We're going to popular tourist places, some out-of-the-way nonsense. We're doing charity work, and I'll probably drink a bunch. But the big twist is that we don't have any control over the trip. All of where we go and what we do is left up to voting through social media to the public. So every morning there's a poll, and we go wherever the public votes for us to go. And what we do that day is left to a vote as well. So everything's left to the viewers, and it all goes through social media. So going on the Internet for us was a really natural extension.
That's great. So, like, give us an idea of, like, one of your episodes. Like, where would we vote for you to go? Give us an idea of how it would go.
Yeah. So, say, I believe the first day, we start day one in Los Angeles, and we have to go to Arizona. So the first two options, I believe, might be Grand Canyon or Phoenix. Well, Grand Canyon and Phoenix is kind of boring. So if we go to the Grand Canyon, we're going to get six people to play a game of capture the flag on donkeys. I wanted to do cowboys and Indians, but apparently that's not PC enough for our producers. So it might be like, well, cowboys and wizards or something. We'll just change the other one. Play
cowboys
some sort of
and
game
Indians
on donkeys.
Indians on horses. All right. We don't want to use donkeys.
Well, some sort of game. And then if we went to Phoenix, it's looking like there might be a demolition derby that day. And then I'd go participate in that. So some of these days are really like high-octane adventure-type stuff. Some of them are kind of learning experiences. One day we're going to be in Dallas. What things do Texans hold dear that we can learn this day? Well, the audience is going to either choose for me to learn how to, you know, fire a gun, or they're going to choose to teach me how to square dance. and whatever they pick is what we do that day.
Okay. All right. I like this. It's kind of like choose your own adventure with Malcolm Freeberg.
With Mel, yeah, right.
Literally the exact inspiration for how it started. We were talking about interactivity, and I, one day I was screwing around with a bunch of old books, like old Goosebumps books I had lying around in my closet. I was like, oh, what if we did this? We'll give a few options, and then the payoff's immediate in those books. So what we're doing is 20-day road trip, 20 episodes. Whatever we shoot on day one is edited, produced, and finalized for the second. Whatever we shoot on the second comes out on the third. So the payoff's still, quick on this stuff.
Are you still rocking the long hair?
I'm still wearing the long hair. I'm still mistaken from a girl from behind, yes.
All right, so now that having, like, the bun and everything is in style, how much do you hate it? That all these people are, like, wearing their hair that way now, they're all growing it out. You notice this, right? Have you noticed this?
Remember, I live in L.A. Like, there's all sorts of freaky hairstyles I have to compete with. I blend in L.A.
Okay.
The odder if I had, like, a normal haircut. But I didn't know this.
No,
the man bun coming into play?
This is a hot new thing. Look it up. It's probably in GQ by now. Men are growing out their hair to wear the bun. They're doing the bun.
Yeah.
It's like the new look.
Well,
and I go, these Malcolm Freeberg wannabes. You can only rock it like Malcolm.
These Lego head hair.
Yeah, right, Lego head hairs. Malcolm, we had Steve Byrne on right before you, and he's the star of Sullivan and Sons. And he was talking about how someone calls him Lego head hair. And I'm like, but that is the stretchiest of name calling I've ever seen.
But
like, that's
funny.
A stretch.
Yeah.
The Lego head hair.
Yeah. That's kind of good. I might be using that this summer for the show. I like Lego head hair.
That's so funny. So let's talk about how this inspiration came up for you to want to do more traveling. Did this have anything to do with Survivor, or is this something you always wanted to do?
Yeah, well, what happened with Survivor, I mean, I was a huge fan of that show growing up. I thought I was going to show up, win the game, have $1 million. I was going to go buy a bar in some, you know, Mexico on some beach somewhere and disappear. Didn't get $1 million. Ended up becoming popular, though. Wasn't my intention at all. Got reached out to from a lot of different venues to do some travel show stuff. What ended up happening was that everyone wanted me to be half naked and starving and miserable in different locations. And
yeah.
I already did that once. We don't want to do that anymore. I'd like to be fed and clothed, please. Doesn't feel like a really expensive demand. A few young producers in L.A. came to me. They wanted to do something really interactive through social media. We kicked around a few ideas, and we ended up landing on this. And we're doing it all indie by ourselves. And that's kind of where it came from. They had the idea. We kicked around a bunch of stuff. I found an old Goosebumps book and said, this is what we should be doing. We figured out how it could be done, and that's the story. That's where we are right now.
No, I believe it. Let me.
The future of reality television was pioneered by R.L. Stein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. go figure. Let me ask you something. Like, you got portrayed on Survivor as kind of like this laid-back, nice guy, blah, 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 whatever. I can't imagine all your moments when you're stuck on an island as you just being a chill, nice guy. Come on, there had to be some moments where you were a dick. A little?
Are you doubting my character, sir?
I'm doubting a little bit of you being... Listen, I'm a fun-loving, like, snarky, like, I'm always making jokes.
Oh, they don't know.
Listen, there are moments where my head's, like, depressed and pissed off and shit. There had to be some of that, right, or no? Or are you, like, 24-7 Encino Man?
I mean, this... nothing's that calm. But, I think I am naturally very laid back and more tolerant than most. I don't have big blow-ups. I have a long fuse. The problem is, like, that when that fuse eventually gets hit, I do go off. And it's not, like, an explosive way or really dramatic. But I took some parting shots at Philip on the second season when I finally was able to get rid of him. So I wasn't always a saint out there. I think just that the people that drove me crazy and the people I did go off on were the people that everyone hated and that everyone wanted somebody to go off on. So my perception and, like, my enemies were the audience's enemies, and I got off a little bit easier than some people.
Yeah, and then I just remember the other thing about you is, of course, and I'm sure you're really humble about this, but still fuck you, is how popular you are with the ladies. This guy, I mean, he looks, you know, I for our audience who's like, oh, Malcolm, which guy was he on Survivor? The real good-looking Tarzan motherfucker. Okay,
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I fucking hate that guy, man.
Yeah, right. You couldn't hate Malcolm. He was the chillest dude in Survivor history. And of course, he looks like Tarzan, and you're like, yeah, all right. That's about right. Yeah. He lucked out in life.
You guys are – I can't tell if you're being sweet or not with all the interspersed swearing.
I'm in Chicago. I'm in Chicago.
This is
sweet.
The best way you can get a compliment.
Yeah, this is the best way I'm ever going to compliment a man's looks, okay?
Right.
I'm winning this conversation right now. Thanks for the heads up.
But what I was going to ask you is there a workout regimen you have to keep in this killer shape that you're in and everything? Like, do you work out? What's the deal?
Here comes
I remember, like, when you saw me on TV, I'd been starving for a month. That's the best I've ever looked in my life. I was tan. So my teeth look good. I, you know, wasn't eating any crap food. Survivor is great for your public appearance.
Is it really? What do you eat? What do you eat when you're on Survivor? Like, I was going to ask about this. So, for instance, I'm imagining Probst and the crew is on, like, some yacht somewhere while you guys are in tents. Correct?
It's a good diet.
I mean, we don't get tents, but, yeah.
You don't even get tents?
We have leaves over our heads.
Was there ever a day where Probst comes off the yacht in the morning and you've been sleeping on the ground with bugs all night and you want to punch him in the fucking face? You're like, this guy, he's showered, he's tan, he's talking about the last episode of whatever he watched last night, Big Bang Theory. Does that ever, like, kill you?
Yeah, I mean, I was out there for, I think, 68 days and total between two seasons. I think on 69 days, like an extra one, I wanted to kick that man in the head whenever he showed his face. He's sitting there all smug, and he's clean, and he's not showing. Yeah, I had a great steak last night. Guys, just like make us feel worse about it. Antagonistic little prick.
Yeah, I just got to imagine I'm trying to think like all the things that if I was on Survivor, I would hate. One would be looking at Jeff Probst come off that yacht every day. Two, where do you go to the bathroom?
Yeah, where do you shit?
Where do you go to the bathroom?
All right, so let me explain.
Okay.
The pooping situation is not as, well, it's not good, but you don't poop that much because you're not eating that much. There's no need to shit when you're only eating 400 calories a day. So this is a once every few days occurrence. But when nature does call, the best thing you can do, and this is not a joke, is go in the ocean. Because it's much cleaner, you get a little sand, you give it one wipe, and you're good to go. Now you got to make sure the tide's going out.
I was going to say, what if the tide's coming your way? Then you're playing dodgeball with your poop.
Yeah.
Yeah, you chase the other direction, and it ends up washing up on the beach, and everyone hates you for it. But,
yeah, right.
Yeah, you have to time up your bowel movements with the moon.
Yeah.
Oh, man. See, that was when I was thinking about. I mean, you guys have to abstain from, like, sex and stuff for 60 days. Now I got to imagine you're a ladies' man. So how do you do that?
Okay.
I mean, it's really not that hard.
That's a hard-hitting question right there.
It is hard-hitting for me. I could not abstain from sex for 60 days. We know Giuliano couldn't without his laptop full of porn.
If you tied his hands together took away from his girlfriend.
His nuts would blow up.
Malcolm, how do you get away from girls that long?
I'll tell you, it's not that hard. Remember, there's no soap. There's no shampoo. There's no razors. There's no nothing out there to, like, make yourself hygienic. And not that particularly bothers me, but in general, nobody's really feeling it. Now, I'm going to tell you a story real quick. There's something called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. I read that in a book. I'm kind of impressed I just spit it out correctly just now.
Right.
So what it is, like, the human psyche, like, what you need out of life, it's like, you need to be comfortable, then you need food, you need shelter, all these things. But you don't have them on Survivor, and sex is like fifth or sixth on the list. So, I mean, I imagine you guys, like myself, wake up with wood at home every morning. That never happens on Survivor. Never.
No?
Because you're not even thinking about that. All your primal needs are, like, taken away from you, that you're not even thinking about sex, and it becomes a running joke amongst all the guys. And there's a lot of young guys out there. Like, we don't have ED, but for a month on Survivor, there's no action downstairs. So it's the weirdest thing in the world that all of a sudden, like, this little guy that usually salutes you in the morning, he isn't doing anything but laying there limply.
See, I'm just afraid because my doctor always says to me, if you don't lose it, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. So I would be, like, nervous.
Yeah, but
I appreciate your concern, but what happened is you speak for the entire race of men, but about halfway through the second season, we won a reward challenge. Sometimes you have these, for people who don't know, you have a contest. If you win it, you get, like, some sort of comfort item. And we got to go to, like, this dessert shop that they built on some island. the weather was perfect, so we had full bellies. The weather was perfect on this island, so, like, we weren't cold or anything at night. We'd have, like, a really good day. There was no stress. Everything was kind of like it would be at home. I woke up in the middle of the night, 1 a.m., and for the first time in maybe 50 days of Survivor, I had a full-on hard-on. Guys! Everyone jumps out of bed. They think it's a rat because we've had rats running over us the past few nights.
No.
Where's the rat?
I lost him during the hard-on story.
Dun, dun, dun.
His plane went down. He's on an island.
Not during the hard-on story.
The suspense is killing me.
No, that was the best. That was the best thing I was ever going to hear.
I was loving.
Oh, I just declared in a loud voice, I have a boner.
Oh, no.
I don't care if I'm on.
What just happened?
No, I need Malcolm to call back. Come on, that was the boner story.
I know.
What did you do, Manny? What did you do?
Hold on.
Here we go. Okay. Wait. Is Malcolm there? Malcolm, are you there? I think we had
to. Yeah, I lost you for a second.
Okay. You were just telling us about your massive boner.
We were held spellbound by
that. You're waking everybody up.
Yeah, we were all leaning on the table listening intently.
Yeah, we were. We really were.
This is sad.
You shut a bunch of Italian and Greek guys
up. This is the highlight of my evening, that you guys are so interested in my boner.
I'm just wondering, because I can't go
We're choosing our own adventure right now. Wayfaring with Malcolm Freeberg's boner. Let's go.
If I go 7 or 8 days without beating off, I start thinking crazy shit. Like I'm like...
You hallucinate.
For no reason. Yeah. It hurts. All right, so go on. Sorry.
So Malcolm wakes up with a boner. This is huge.
I wake up with a boner. I alert the entire camp to the fact, like, that, guys, everyone jumps up because they think it's a rat. Wait, where is it? I yell at the top of my lungs in the middle of the Filipino jungle, I have a boner! And I got a round of applause from the entire crew and the castaways.
Must have looked like a road flare.
Oh, it was painful. It's one of those painful ones, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's pent up for, like, 3 months.
Yeah, one of those we have to make sure it still works ones. Yeah. Those hurt. wow. See, okay, so that was a Survivor question I had. Mike, what were you thinking about Survivor? What happens when the cameras aren't on?
Well, that's my thing. How much is...
scripted,
yeah,
you were
asking.
How much
is BS and how much is scripted? Because here's the thing I know about reality TV shows. Not many of them have a whole lot of real going on. So I'm sure there's some real aspects of Survivor. But, I mean, was the producer ever like... Hold on, wait, can you do that again, but do it this way? Did you ever have any of that going on?
More rednecky?
That's interesting.
Yeah, you got to remember that Survivor was the first mover in American reality TV. They were the first one. Back in the day, Mark Burnett just dropped 16 people off on an island and just said, go have fun, like, let's see what happens. So they've maintained a lot more of the quote-unquote realness than a lot of the shows that have come out lately that you hate because you know it's so obviously fake. So Survivor is much, much better about that than most. That being said, it's never intrusive. It never affects any of, like, the action or what's going on. But if, like, a camera, like, didn't get, like, something was technically wrong with, like, a conversation, they missed something, they might go, hey, would you mind, like, repeating that, just in case. But that's maybe once every several days.
You are fighting for $1 million. I would imagine if anything seems scripted into someone's favor, the cast would revolt.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, it's because the stakes are so high.
Well, you know,
like,
how Malcolm got voted off. Do you know how Malcolm got voted off the first time he was on? Malcolm let this girl's brother come into the camp to visit the tribe's camp. Like, it was his prerogative to say, yeah, he could come visit. And then he told her to vote him off. So the good deed that Malcolm did, the good deed that this bro does, he gets voted off for. That had to piss you off.
Yeah, step you get for bringing Christians home.
yes! Love it.
So, Malcolm, I got to ask you a question. So after being on the show for 2 seasons, is there any secret to success on that show, or is it literally just making sure people don't hate you?
Made it deep. The first season he was on, he fourth place.
Well, I mean, so I'm asking, what's the magic?
I mean, it's nothing physical. Oh, it's Survivor, and like, oh, you're out in the wild and all that stuff, but none of the physical stuff matters. It's all mental. It's being able to, like, deal. You're going to be in shit situations. It's going to be miserable. You're going to have a ton of people that you'd rather, like, stick it straight in their like neck instead of actually having to work with. So it's all about mental stuff, much more so than the actual physical surviving part. The smart guys always do better, and the people who are kind of cool, calm, and collected, you're always going to see do better than, oh my God, this guy was a Navy SEAL and he survived 18 different like fatal accidents and stuff like that. Well, he's probably shit at Survivor. It's the smart people that do well.
Is that some kind of metaphor for life, though? Is that really being the most cunning is the way to succeed, do you think?
Well, I mean, if you listen to Game of Thrones, it is. I kind of buy into that. I hope so. I consider myself to have a dash of cunning beyond underneath this great head of hair, which you were kind enough to comment upon earlier. I certainly like to believe that the world goes around because of cunning instead of like muscles and stuff like that.
Let me ask you this. I got two questions for you when you prepped for Survivor, and I got to imagine you probably have gained some weight back since Survivor, so on the wayfaring, we'll probably see a healthier Malcolm, I'm assuming. I know that you lost weight to prepare for Survivor, which is an interesting method because some people I would assume probably bulk up and stuff. How'd you go about losing weight, especially already a thin guy?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, let's not give me too much credit here. I found out that I was going to have a shirt off and a bunch of HD cameras pointed at me. I wanted to look good. Vanity played, you know, a role here. But it also was like a conscious strategic decision because you can pack on a bunch of pounds, and yeah, sure, you have like an extra energy store when the starvation sets in, but that's not going to last you over a month, which is how long Survivor lasts. So I did knock my metabolism down like the month leading up to the show. I started like backing off the calories, so I lost weight. It made me look good. That was just an extra benefit, though, because it really was about getting used to the starving. So come day two or three, when you start hearing the grumblings from everybody and it starts putting them in a bad mood, I was already used, not to that degree, but my body was prepared for being on a like calorie deficit. And it really did pay off, like just being ready for that condition. There was a guy out there with me. He's a CrossFitter. He ate 5,000 calories a day and burned 6, and he had abs for days. He was miserable. He couldn't function after 3 days because he burnt at such a high level in society he wasn't ready for being on a depreciated diet. So I always tell people, if you're going to go out on that show, make sure you're training for the conditions and not like the real world where you have access to a refrigerator and food and normal people, stuff like that.
Wow. And by the way, what college did you graduate from? You're an Ivy League guy, right?
Yes, sir. Dartmouth.
Dartmouth, okay. That's a good school last time I checked. Not a good basketball team, but a good school. You play football, correct? You're a football player, right?
Yeah, people give me too much credit for that whole mental stuff. I just tackled real good, real well. Sorry.
You just tackled really good? Yeah. Excuse me, I'm not trying to be offensive at all here with this. It's a weird question to ask. Yeah, it's just going to happen naturally.
I've already told the boner story, and you admitted to having a crush on me, so we can't
I feel like we're good friends now, and I can ask this.
Right.
Okay, you went to Dartmouth, and before you did Survivor, you were a bartender. How do you go from Dartmouth to bartender? How did this happen?
It's actually quite easy to get a job as a bartender with an Ivy League education.
Well, I'm sure it is. but you see what I'm saying? Like, you're not a Wall Street guy. You're not a whatever, wherever all the Ivy Leaguers go. I'm not smart enough to know. But I find it fascinating that you're in Hermosa Beach bartending.
Yeah, so what happened was I was a finance guy. I did corporate real estate all through college. That was the career path. Got to be end of my internship before senior year, and I hated myself because it was just the most miserable soul-sucking job on the planet. So I told them I didn't want the job next year, and I had to find something else. After college, I spent a year as an elementary school teacher overseas, like a Peace Corps type program. I spent a year living literally on an island, fishing for my dinner, and teaching elementary school 5 days a week. And that was kind of like spur of the moment. Well, then towards the end of that, my best friend on the island, when I say best friend, he's the only other guy who would drink heavily with me. He grew up in L.A. He said, hey, I can get us jobs in L.A. as bartenders. Why don't we go do that for a bit? I said, all right, I'll go do that. Again, just like spur-of-the-moment type stuff.
Yes.
I was going to stay in L.A. for a year. I was about to leave, get on Survivor, just kind of, and I applied and stuff like that, but it was kind of on a whim, so spur-of-the-moment. And now that's kind of translating nicely into the show this summer. Wayfaring, whatever it says goes.
Right, it's spur of the moment. I mean, this Wayfaring, I'm totally – it's on Kickstarter right now. It just started today. You guys have already raised $2,400. We're trying to reach $9,000. I'm sure you'll take extra. So we're
not
trying
be
to
upset.
raise Yeah, you won't be upset about that. Explain to me, so 9,000 for one episode, 9,000 for a few episodes, how's this work?
It's not episode-based. We came up with a budget. Somebody smarter than me with numbers got a calculator out and figured out that that's what we need to actually complete the trip. We didn't factor in food and gas and things like that front end. Now, we have some financing already set to go at the beginning. This is literally just the last little chunk we need to make sure that we're a go. But in exchange for that, you're getting access to the event in ways that, like, it's a little almost Big Brother. I hate making that reference, but we're going to have exclusive content on the website if you've bought into the low level to the Kickstarter. There's private polls. Not all of them are going to be open to the public, only for people who've bought in at X number of dollars. Live Q&As with me from the road, one-on-one phone calls, executive decisions, even meeting us out on the road. Everything through the Kickstarter is a way to be more involved in the event this July.
Okay. So in code, what you're saying is, dear public, I'd like to have a cross-country road trip paid for $9,000. No? Okay. I got to tell you, here's why I believe that. Oh, well, here's why I don't believe it. I'd take the $9,000 and be like, yeah, we're going to film in Vegas for 3 weeks. See ya.
You've clearly never been to Vegas. You think $9,000 would last me that long.
$9,000 would last me long in Vegas because I'll turn it into 27 and we'll stay a couple more weeks.
Oh, yes.
Oh, he's that guy.
Yeah,
I tell myself that every time. Well, to get to that point, it's not because it does sound like just, oh, yeah, give me some money and then I'm going to go on a road trip. I'd really appreciate it. Not all of the options that the audience has are positive things. One morning, the poll may be, hey, Malcolm gets you can either give Malcolm donuts and champagne for breakfast, or we found a drill instructor from a nearby military base. He's going to go run Malcolm through drills before we start the day. A lot of tortuous options are available to the audience. The producers have already found it. I'm terrified about this.
Do you feel like they're – in the nudist colonies where they're going to put you. Do you feel like do you feel like they're purposely setting you up, though, to, like, it's not going to be, like, 49%, 51%?
Yeah.
It's going to be Malcolm eats Cheerios or Malcolm gets beat up by a bunch of grade schoolers. Well, I'm going to vote for the grade schoolers beating his ass. That's great TV.
Yeah.
Do you feel
hopefully they're giving it 50-50. But, again, the producers, I was involved more earlier, and ever since it's gotten down to, like, the real details of the planning, they've started keeping secrets from me because they don't want me to know what's coming. So I don't
know
exactly. I just know it's not always going to be fun.
If there's anything Fear Factor-esque or anything where Malcolm's naked, you know you're going to lose that vote every time. That's going to win all the time.
Pretty much.
Fear Factor Malcolm and Naked Malcolm. 90% every time. You might as well plan your day out already. You know what's going to happen.
90%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just don't talk me out of this now, guys. I had this fun, great idea
for a show. You're fucked now. You're on Kickstarter, bro. There's no backing down now. People have already given their coin.
Nope.
You're screwed. Why Kickstarter? Can I ask you why Kickstarter when obviously guys like yourself and I'm sure some of your friends know some rich guys that could toss you some money?
Yeah, we could do that. And we did, like, at the beginning, we had private funding to get us started. But one of the cool things about the show is that it's all audience-driven. Like, everything's going to be, keep talking about, it's all chosen by the audience. Well, through Kickstarter, it serves half as publicity, like, get people excited about the event beforehand. And also, like we talked about, you can buy in at certain levels to have even more control. But the cool thing about it is that whatever the people give us is going to increase the grandeur of their choices. So, like, by reaching out to the people who are actually going to be watching the show, well, if we have a lot more money, or if we have no money, then maybe we have to, like, sit in the parking lot of Space Camp and can't actually go in. But if we have more money, we can actually go into Space Camp. If we have no money, I have to think of very primitive ways to torture my interns. If we have a lot of money, I can do crazy, inventive, horrible stuff to them. So even the scale of how big we can make the show is going to be dictated by the audience response to the Kickstarter.
So here's what I say. Here's a poll. Malcolm comes to Chicago, and what would you say if Malcolm came to Chicago, Mikey? Where are some choices?
Spends the night at the Bijou Theater.
Spends the night at the Bijou Theater, or has to spend the evening with the Guidos, and I'm going to take him to Boys Town.
Oh.
He'd have to spend the night. Oh, he would get
Or
mauled.
He spends one night
no,
with...
Jack, he, could go, the, he has to dance as a drag queen of Berlin.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I like that
yeah.
one.
He has to survive a night at Richard's when everybody's smoking
right.
in there with us.
I'm saying it right now. I'm Holy producing God. Season two. I'm putting yeah. it together right now.
Right.
I didn't know Malcolm was such a whore for these
for
punishments that we're going to give him.
We'll make a
I really hope the people who are actually planning this trip aren't listening right now because this
no,
is
I hope
terrible.
So. I hope so. I'm liking it already. I'm going to take you to a drag show and we're going to put you in drag.
Well,
this,
I mean, it's going to be
go ahead.
No, it's going to be a really really hard decision for the watchers of the show.
Oh yeah,
dance as a drag queen at Berlin or have dinner at Spiaggia.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll make it real hard. Give him a 4-star cuisine or make him dress up in drag.
Well, this interview's been fun, guys. My time's running out.
I mean, but I got to imagine your producers are going to come up with crazy shit like this. You're going to be kind of out there. And by the way, so this is going to be a total surprise to you every day, of course, these 20 days, correct?
Yeah.
Not everything. I'll have, like, some heads up. I'm involved in some of the planning, but they've gone dark on a few days and a few options. They're being very tight-lipped about it, which is terrifying.
Well, I think they do. We want the natural reaction out of Malcolm when we watch this show. I mean, this is going to be a great show. I'm actually in love with this idea, the wayfaring. I'm in love with it.
It's interesting, but then your choices of what you're going to do are only going to be as interesting or inventive as the public that watches it, which might limit you in some sex. I mean...
Yeah,
there was a movie last year. It's a new movie by Paul Verhoeven, who directed Basic Instinct
mm-hmm.
and RoboCop,
Black Book
called
and, yep.
Tricked,
yep.
in which they filmed 10 minutes of a movie of a story. They gave mm-hmm. it, you know, and then basically people through social media sent them what they wanted to happen next, and so they filmed 10 minutes at a time
yep.
and picking audience suggestions that they liked best. They made a movie the way you're doing this show. And I think that movie is ultimately going to only be as interesting as the people submitting the topics and the ideas are familiar with drama and storytelling and things like that. Do you think that Do you think that helps or limits this kind of show?
You know, what you just said was a concern when we first started talking about this idea, that if we just leave it completely open-ended – well, people are. This might not end up that well. We don't trust the public to know what's going to be the best thing, but we trust our team and the producers who are planning this. So that's
right.
the way it's like a choose-your-own-adventure, but there's only limited options each day, and those limited options are going to be entertaining. They are going to be good story opportunities. We're not letting you – we don't trust you to give you full control. We'll give you options that are going to be entertaining. So it's not completely open-ended so that we can avoid exactly what you're talking about.
I almost feel like if – like Reddit got a hold of this or the internet, like the hardcore internet, like Reddit, I have a feeling they'll be more interesting than any producer would ever put together.
Well,
because those guys are crazy. They'd come up with nutballs.
It's really like someone submitted idea, like he participates in a strike for labor.
Have you realized, too, this makes like a great plot for a horror movie?
Yeah.
I'm surprised Jason Blum isn't, like, chomping at the bit to turn this into a horror movie. Yeah. Malcolm Freeberg,
you know,
choose your own adventure.
But here's the other thing, too. I think when you look at the media format going from a movie to a TV, there's a lot more instant gratification with a TV than there is in a movie.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I mean, I'll give you an example. How great would it be to see Malcolm at, like, a haunted house overnight? Like, one of those haunted motels.
Oh, yeah.
That's
Chicago, actually. They
that
found some insane
Chicago?
Asylum in Illinois somewhere. They found some insane asylum.
Oh, well,
I don't know exactly.
Joliet, the one in Joliet.
It's either the one in Joliet or the really, really old deserted one in Barrington that would be fantastic.
Oh, that could be too. Yeah, that could be.
I don't know exactly.
The one
I don't
in
know exactly. These guys are on it, though, and I did hear insane asylum, Illinois.
I like insane asylum, and I'd keep it at that. The only options I'd give the viewers, since I don't trust them, is shirtless or shirted. That way we know you're at least in the insane asylum.
Right.
There's no way around
wait.
It.
Do you want him fully clothed
yeah,
or
right.
do you want him in no shirts and no shoes?
Ponytail or hair down?
do you want him with a gun for protection or he has to do mushrooms?
Oh, that's what we should do. Malcolm Freeberg, insane asylum in Barrington or a night on like 33rd and State.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Well, if it's one in Barrington,
it's turning into Die Hard with a Vengeance.
It's an old hospital / insane asylum. It's been deserted. All the metal equipment's still there.
Okay.
Some man owns the property. And nobody's been in there for like 40 years.
Okay.
And like some people broke in, like went in a window. There's fucking needles and like old pills and all kinds of crazy shit.
Oh, that'd be great. How do your producers set up getting these locations you're going to be using? Is this determined ahead of time so that you guys don't have to worry about getting locked out of somewhere?
Yeah, we want to have it all 90% planned well in advance, especially the big options like that. But, like, again, if we end up in Chicago, and like it's what you just said, Insane Asylum or sound like a nice hotel, that's planned in advance. But some of this stuff will be spur of the moment. Just we drive by some stupid gas station. We have to stop for gas. We might pull a pole up. It's only open for 10 minutes. What does Malcolm have to start a conversation with the clerk about? Cooking recipes.
I just feel bad.
I don't know,
like,
flirt, stuff like that.
You're like the nicest bro ever. Like, if this was some asshole, like if it was Joe Rogan, I would like to see him tortured a little, even though I love Joe Rogan. Don't get me wrong. But, like, Joe Rogan has that kind of attitude where, like,
right.
You'd like to see. Like, he hosted Fear Factor for so long. You're like,
right.
This motherfucker.
Right.
He's always picking on all these people that can't eat 100 worms. You eat 100 worms,
like
Joe Rogan.
I'd like to see Alex Trebek.
Right, but
some
Malcolm's
trick.
So nice. And you know people, even though they know how nice he is, they're still going to choose, like, the most torturous thing or the most potentially dramatic thing. And I'm like, but he's such a good dude.
Does the lowest common denominator just have to set the bar for everything?
Yes.
Oh.
For a show like The Wayfaring, I'll tell you right now, I think the lowest common denominator should set the bar for it because it makes for the most fascinating road trip show ever.
But then, do only people who care, what's going to happen?
Uh-oh.
Oh, God.
I thought the show was starting already.
Yeah, right.
But then again, do only people who care enough to turn in something are going to be the people that actually think through their response?
Well, that's the thing. A lot of the Kickstarter people, that their vote's based off of you gave money to Kickstarter, so you're the voter.
Right.
So they're invested in it. They're like, and that's why I love this Kickstarter idea. They're invested. You've invested these people into what you're doing.
It's good.
Exactly.
Is anybody joining you on this road trip at all, or is it just you?
Well, it's going to be very self-aware with the crew. So, like, these cast of characters behind the camera isn't invisible. They're going to be involved in the show. So I mentioned I might go play Cowboys and Wizards on Donkeys in the Grand Canyon. If we have to get 6 people to play that game, it's going to be 5 people that we decide from the crew are completely incapable of riding a donkey. Like, members of the crew are part of the show and be characters in and of themselves.
I got to tell you what, when my producer came to me and they go, we're going to have Malcolm Freeberg on, I'm like, oh, he's not on Survivor anymore, but I could ask a million Survivor questions. And he brought up the Wayfaring, and I'm like, yeah, what the fuck is that, whatever. I was, like, vaguely interested. I'm like, whatever. I got to tell you, I'm going to watch this. I'm kind of shocked that you guys are doing this on the web. I get why, because you could do it immediately. It's very immediate. But I mean, this is a huge idea. This is something I'm shocked you didn't pitch around town as a travel channel series or something. It's almost too risky, though. It's almost too risque for a travel channel show.
Well,
that's basically what we came up with. What you just, like, we're stoked about. I'm glad we won you over. But when you go over and talk about this idea, and I took it a couple places, like, really tepidly to see, like, test the waters. No one wants to do it because, like, the production schedules match 20 episodes in 20 days. Is insanity. Right. Like, what we're saying we're going to do isn't possible without, like, idealists and interns, really. Like, people have to be dedicated to the idea, and you're not going to get Union LA crews to come out and do that. They have to sleep in proper hotels and only work 8 hours, and then they get overtime. Our crew is so stoked about this idea, they're really into it, that they're going to work the crazy hours necessary to put it out this summer.
I mean, you do realize you're basically doing the equivalent of an independent film. And, I hope it's hit you how great the feeling is to do something that's totally yours with a crew that's like, yeah, we're not going to sleep anywhere expensive. No 3-star motels, let alone 4. They're not going to get paid union wages, probably, whatever. I mean, you got to be kind of stoked about it, though. This is like your indie movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it feels that way. We feel like a little gritty and against the man, and everyone being so excited about it has become contagious on the crew, and everyone's so invested that it feels like something special. We know the idea is good, but there's this really great feeling that we know what we're doing is awesome. It's really become infectious is the only word for it amongst, like, there's 13 of us on this trip.
It's such a huge idea for a show. I mean, man, this is a, I mean, I cannot believe, like, this isn't on CBS or something. This is a big idea.
Yeah.
This is a big idea. Like, I'm just blown away. I think everyone should feel very fortunate that you're making this into a web series, too, because we're going to get to see, a 1,000%, like, your decisions, your creativity, you and your producers and stuff. No studio machine stopping you at all. I think that's fucking awesome. I mean, because this is something that's like a big idea. This is great.
Yeah, we're really stoked about it. It's going to be all us. There's no filters because we're on the internet. We're hosting it all on our own website, wayfaringlive.com. Like, it's all us, no man to shut us, and it's going to make it 10 times more fun.
Did you tell Probst you were doing this?
Nah, fuck that guy.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
Fuck
Probst.
Yacht.
His fucking yacht. Gets off his yacht. He jerked off in the morning like a normal man. He probably had hookers on there.
Yeah.
Fucking Probst.
Yeah.
These guys that host these shows like Survivor, I'll cut Julie Chen slack since she's married to my boy Les Moonves, but like Survivor and Fear Factor and these guys, man, they got a fucking set on them.
Yeah.
I can't stand them.
Yeah.
I want to see, would it hurt Jeff Probst to be a contestant for 1 year on Survivor and let someone else host?
Let's make a show where we get all these guys together and have a sit with
them. I want to see Rogan and Probst, those guys on Survivor. I bet they wouldn't last half as long as Malcolm lasts.
Right.
I'm just saying.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? Like, Probst thinks he's hard, but see how he does after a week of starving and not having his steak and nice
he's
fresh clothes to go
hard.
Home to
he gets, he's fucking hard. He gets 200 grams of protein a day and hits the gym on the yacht.
His arteries are
hard.
Hard.
Yeah, right. Your workout's like fucking starving in the desert. Oh, my God. I got to tell you, so the wayfaring, you're doing this for 20 days. I got to assume you got something lined up after this, too, because this is, what a crazy project. It just kind of comes and goes. What's the follow-up?
You know, we've got ideas for the future, can't get too much into it, but the selling point or the thing that's going to make this go is the format, the interactivity, and the immediate gratification from a next day episode. Now, we might have to go shorter form with some ideas, but we've got some really cool stuff. If we do well this summer, we've got some really cool ideas, maybe two shorter form projects by the end of the year. That would be really, really cool. Same format, we'll do it ourselves unless somebody throws us some money, but we'll see.
So this is turning into like the Malcolm Freeberg network. You got your own network.
It's not all me. And again, when in the future we grab Joe Rogan and make him do one of these, or we grab
Fuck Joe Rogan. He's off. He's off. You know what? I've had it with that guy. He's talented, but I've had it with him. I want him to eat bugs. I want him to do that shit. Yeah, you should get him to do that. I would pay good money to watch him do Fear Factor for one episode. Rogan's a tough guy, though. I bust his balls, but he does.
He's tough. He's an MMA guy.
I heard he's gonna fight.
Really?
What I heard.
He's actually a martial arts guy.
Malcolm, you're not an MMA guy. Do you watch the UFC? Yeah.
I watch. I don't never participated. Thank heaven. I like sitting back with a beer and watching. But no, I'll never do it.
Man. Were you born with great genes, or were you just like, did you have to learn to be the coolest guy on the planet?
Liquor helps.
I'm just like, this guy just blows me away. He's just like the chillest motherfucker, and like, I kind of want to hate him. Because he's like the McConaughey TV.
Yeah, I was
going to
say that.
He's like
that.
The
he's
McConaughey
like,
of reality TV.
You could be like, hey, fuck you, man. He'd be like, well, whatever, man, whatever
Listen,
you think.
I'm gonna
that's what McConaughey would say.
Listen, I'm keeping Freeberg around as a friend just so I could say I'm friends with like the McConaughey of reality TV. That's what I'm going to do.
Oh, boy.
Oh, you guys are going to make me blush. You keep going on like this.
Who needs women? You got me.
Yeah.
I'll make you feel special. Mikey's making you feel special, I'm sure. What are you doing, Mikey?
Whisper sweet nothing.
Are you watching The Wayfaring? No, not yet.
I'm trying to find, you know, there's some stuff about
him. Oh, he's searching. Mikey's looking at all your pictures right now.
You're being cross-referenced.
He's cross-referencing.
Oh, God.
You.
With all that talk of boners early, now I'm concerned.
Yeah, right.
What y'all do in that studio.
Do you ever think about playing Shaggy in the next Scooby-Doo movie?
Oh, he couldn't do Shaggy.
Do you hear what he just said in that studio?
Yeah, in the studio,
where
right.
We're doing this?
Yeah, right. We do have a studio. We used to have
too much credit.
We actually did.
Here's what we did. We used to have a studio, and then I decided to come home to make an indie film like you're making your indie show. No, this is the truth. He's laughing at me. Yeah. See, Freeberg can't even take me seriously. We're making an indie film here. And while we're making this indie film, so you come home. I know what it's like to do this kind of thing on a budget that you're doing your show on. You come home, and instead of staying in my apartment in L.A., I am in my parents' basement.
Yeah.
For like seven, 8 months, and like I want to kill myself.
Yeah,
basically.
That where's that reality show?
Malcolm Freeberg is so LA though. Like I'm feeling his like beachness right now. That like I'm missing LA.
What if he actually did? What if he actually did stay here and like this turned out to be the hardest reality challenge he ever saw? Just
oh,
like,
doing,
I can't take this shit anymore.
Doing our show?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
no, just doing.
Be.
Yeah,
doing our indie.
You guys keep. I can't. This is easy. I get no one's telling me what to do. I just get to mouth off with you clowns.
I should. Yeah, I should have put you in my movie because that would have been the Wayfarer. That would have been you would have been fucked, pal. Yeah. Let me tell you how many headaches you had with that.
Yeah.
Well, how many headaches you have making a movie?
We're on our eighth, ninth lead actor.
Do you guys have headaches when you're making like a low budget? When you're making like I don't want to say low budget. When you're making an independent web series
Other
like
people
this,
get
though,
paid to have the headaches.
What are your headaches like on that? Do you have any?
I mean, I give out the headaches. I kick people in the head for being idiots with stupid decision making. Is what happens.
Decision makers have the headaches. The producers have the headaches. You kind of let them deal with it.
Yeah.
Well, and then I do some of the producing work, but a lot of the planning stuff is where we're at right now. They have to deal with, but a lot of the setting up and managing of stuff is a lot of juggling on my end, and it gets stressful. But it's fun because, like you said earlier, once you're doing your own project and you don't have anybody telling you what to do, it's very liberating and empowering, and it's a really cool feeling not to have anybody to kiss ass to.
Yeah, you feel very free right now. When does the Wayfaring start? When's the date on that?
We leave L.A. on the 1st of July, meaning the first episode is going to come out on the 2nd. We go for 20 days, ending back in L.A. on July 20th, simple math. 20
awesome.
Episodes, 20 days. You can find them on wayfaringlive.com. Follow, just get my plug in, Wayfaring Live on Twitter and Instagram as well. All the updates will come through that for stuff on the show.
Well, I think it's really cool that you're doing this. I'm really glad you did the show here. I'm going to watch for sure.
I appreciate it, guys. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Malcolm. Yep. Have a good night, all right?
Yep.
Take it easy, guys. Don't drink my boner.
All right, brother. He now thinks we like his boner.
Yeah, I got my own boner.
And there's a difference between liking his boner and liking his boner story.
That's true.
Thank you, Mikey. Thank you for clearing that one.
Now he thinks we're all...
I got to bring Mikey everywhere with me where something kind of gay happens, because Mikey will be like, here's the difference.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, listen to him. He says it better than I do.
It'll be like the old Animaniac short, good idea, bad idea.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Gay,
right. Not gay.
Right. Oh, I sent this picture to Lenny the other day, and it's like one of those one picture, other picture kind of things, like where the one picture's on top and then the next picture's on the bottom of the same two people.
Yeah.
And it's of, what's his name that's married to Olivia Wilde that was on SNL? Jason Sudeikis. Sudeikis and Andy Samberg, and they're wearing shirts. Sudeikis says not, and Samberg says gay. And then in the next picture, Sudeikis walks away, and it's just Samberg standing there and says gay, and he goes, where the fuck you go? I go, we should do that. That'd be pretty funny. Not gay, and then you get it. So, yeah, Malcolm Freeberg, not gay, bro. We do like boner stories, though.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm a child.
He got up and told everybody on set, and they all cheered for him.
Yeah.
Pat Tobias says that was both the most entertaining and gayest interview he's ever heard. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I aim to please my demographic.
Well, since I've been friends with Pat for 3 years now, and I've never met him.
Yeah. Talk about entertaining.
He's a great
gay.
Friend. Yeah.
Yeah, right, right. Tobias...
Tobias.
Is he working on the film? Anthony.
I mean,
you're Mr. I'm the producer.
I mean, I'm really
no
getting,
one else produces
I'm getting
around
desperate here.
You said I don't produce. That's what you said to me the other day.
Produce me a sandwich.
What do you and Lenny do? That's what you said to me the other day. You look at Lenny and I, you go, what do you do? Yeah, I know you were mad.
What did he say when you said that?
Oh, the best was, we leave the movie theater, right?
Uh-huh.
You want to hear a story?
Did you get a drunk phone call from Giuliano?
No, this is the greatest ever. Lenny opens the door. And Lenny, you know, Lenny slams the door open. He's a big fucking guy. So the door flings open. So there's plenty of time for me to walk through the door and not have to hold the door open. Chucky's behind me. As soon as I walk through the door comes slamming into Chucky's face. Hits him in the face. Chucky walks outside. He goes, you motherfucker. I go, what, Chuck? He goes, that door just hit me in the fucking face, you fucking asshole. I go, what are you so mad about? I didn't do anything. He goes, the door slammed in my face. I didn't do anything. Lenny's standing there with that, like, don't want to laugh Lenny look on his face
yeah.
where you know he's ready to, like, bust up. He's beet red.
Yeah, beet red.
Like, cheeks are growing
yeah.
from all the air he has
yeah.
to conceal.
His jowls are rippling.
And Chucky turns to me and goes, you cocksucking motherfucker. I should punch you in the face right fucking now. He goes, I'm going home. And he walks away, gets in his car, and drives off at, like, 75 miles per hour. And I'm like, what the fuck just happened? It was the worst. The night before, we're on the boat, and I go, Chucky, meet us at the boat, and we're going to go get dim sum. Chucky gets stuck in this parking lot that he can't enter. It has this, like, gate, and there's no guy at the gate after 8 p.m. I guess there's no guy at the gate ever anymore anyways. Chucky can't get in, so he calls me. He goes, where the fuck am I? I'm trying to give him directions. And I'm like, well, you need to go a couple more blocks north. He goes, fuck you, motherfucker. I'm just going to go home if I can't get a fucking parking spot. I go, Charles, I'm not. Stop being an asshole. I'm like, I'm not doing anything. I'm giving you directions. Lenny's standing there. He goes, what the fuck's wrong with him? He's like, I can hear both of you. You're assholes, all of you. I'm going home. I'm like, someone's not getting any.
Chuck.
I don't know. Ever since
he got this
girlfriend.
Charles has been getting edgy for like the last like 6 months.
Since he got this girlfriend, there's been some
you know what he's turning into the grumpy 50-year-old Italian man.
He is.
He really is a close friend of you guys that really just does not like any of you, though.
No.
I mean,
no,
he
can't stand
like any of you.
He's so close to like Walter Matthau status, though.
Yeah.
It's like not even funny.
Really?
Yeah, Anthony got mad at Lenny and I. Once again, Lenny and I don't really feel like we did anything wrong, okay? And we're at the movies, and I joked around. I used the word delegate just to piss Anthony
off.
Well,
usually Lenny does something wrong, and then you stand there and giggle like a little girl.
That's exactly what
so
happened.
So you told she's Anthony like, delegate.
Len, I think you're mad.
yeah.
Oh, did you hear Chuck?
You guys.
And Len goes, yeah, man, I heard him. Fuck them. Who cares?
Yeah.
Okay, Len. That's usually how it goes.
Yeah.
This is pretty much what happened because he was talking about how Steve called the guy that's in charge of the Pride Parade.
Right.
And I go, yeah, I delegated that to Steve. And you know how the word delegate for Anthony is like a starting point.
Yeah, that's the word of the day in Pee Wee's
Playhouse. It's
the
Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, right.
And
then Lenny goes, and he just looks at Anthony and goes, why don't we have one of those blue accordion folders that hold all our producing papers, Anthony? And Anthony snaps.
Wow.
At the word accordion folder, it was over.
Wait, you snapped on Lenny or Chuck?
Me and Lenny.
Okay.
He snapped on me and Lenny. It was over.
He hates that word.
Delegate fired him up. And then the firecracker went off at, yeah, and where are those blue accordion folders? Why don't we have one of those? And Anthony snapped. He goes, to hold what? What the fuck do you two motherfuckers do? You two fucking cunts don't do anything. You don't do anything. And he says, you two fucking cunts. As these girls get out of this minivan to get into the movie theater, these three, like, 14-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And Anthony screams, you cunt.
Yeah.
And these girls are like,
You're at a screening of Maleficent.
They've never heard this word ever. They had to be going to Maleficent.
Yeah.
They never heard this word before, and these three girls are just like, huh? Like, they were, oh, it was so bad. And he keeps going. He doesn't even care. We're like, those girls, Anthony. He goes, fuck you. What the fuck do you two do ever anyways? And don't get me started on Luisi. I'm like, no one brought up Luisi.
Yeah.
I just keep looking at Lenny, and I go, what's going on?
Oh,
and he's
man.
Like, fuck you. This isn't funny. And we're like, but it kind of is because we didn't do anything.
Oh man!
Oh,
so you just now, you just say the word delegate whenever like you're doing something and he won't like something is happening. Like Anthony, come on, get the popcorn. We already got the sodas.
Yeah.
Get the delegate.
Yeah, delegate the popcorn order.
Yeah,
it's over.
He did snap on me at the car the other day when we had to go put the flyers out.
Did
he?
Oh,
and I was laying into him.
You two snapped on each other. Mikey turned around and he goes, "Get the fuck out of the car. Go put the fucking flyers out. Just get it over with." What the fuck?
That was not something I was planning on doing.
I got to tell you.
So angry.
As much as we all bust each other's balls, you know this like group of friends is a group of friends because we've all been so awful to each other during the making of this film that if we didn't secretly like each other, people would be dead. There would be bodies dropped.
We are. I mean, and I'm including myself in it.
Yeah, right.
We are the 30-year-old male Golden Girls.
Yeah,
there's no way they're around it. That's who we are.
Except cussing, violent, angry,
violent.
B. Arthurs.
Alcoholics.
Next week on the show, Nick Temple's joining us. He's the CEO of Wildcard Creative Agency. They make the trailers for basically every major movie.
Really?
All
cool.
The superhero movies.
I'll
have
to get them on the trailer for ours.
I'm sure I have that kind of studio money laying around that they make these trailers for.
I might have to sit out for
this one.
I got a bone or two to pick with.
I'm pumped about it. I told Pat, of course Pat had to explain to me who Nick Temple is. I mean, I don't know who Nick Temple is, sure. And they explained it to me, and I go, oh, that's a really cool interview. Because we've never gone behind the marketing scenes of what makes a studio movie a studio movie.
That is interesting. Because
a trailer kind of makes or breaks your movie.
It does, but the trailers make me all mad.
Yeah,
even if the movie's really good.
Well, they're supposed to make guys like you mad.
Yeah, but...
You hate every form of marketing
and
capitalism.
You do.
No, I know. They promote their product. Just every trailer is like 1 second cuts, and they're screaming at you, explosions.
And you should ask him why.
Okay, I'm gonna
ask him how...
I won't be rude.
No, it's not. I don't think it's rude. I think that's a great question.
Yeah.
Why is it cut like an MTV music video trailers?
Hey.
But I think there's a reason. I think there's an answer
to it. Yeah, there's definitely a reason they found out for them. Hey, here's a question. Is Maleficent?
Maleficent?
Yeah, right over.
Yep.
Yeah. Is it supposed to be...
You haven't seen you and me talk about going to see it, have you?
I wasn't expecting that.
I'm in no rush.
I caught about 40 minutes of it in between screenings at the AMC on Illinois one day. And
yeah.
It wasn't,
there
wasn't doing it for
there
me.
There isn't anything I've been jumping to see yet. A Million Ways to Die in the West, that was an accident. We went to Lido's for dinner, and we just went, hey, you want to go see a movie? Yeah. I mean, outside of that, there
you
hasn't been anything I'm, like, lining up for. Except 22 Jump Street we're seeing.
Yeah, that'll be pretty
you
funny.
You should go with me to see Cold in July. It's a fucking murder story in Texas. It's got Sam Shepard. It's got Sam Shepard,
like
Don Johnson,
thrillers.
And Michael
Keep
C.
Talking.
Hall.
Oh, you could get that on video on demand, though.
Oh, well, all right, then.
Who sees that at the theaters when I can order it on the tube?
I saw Ex Molester, Days of Futures Past.
I saw it, too.
Yeah.
It was all right.
Eh.
It
wasn't bad.
Eh. It was all right. It wasn't great.
Wasn't great.
Wasn't bad. It was all right.
I will tell you that.
The
I'm
people
like,
creaming
I'm like
their
three
pants
X-Men movies
it.
Behind, though.
Me,
so
me too.
I don't even
me
care.
It was good, but I will tell you this. Have you seen First Class yet?
No.
It's
sitting in that pile I told
it,
you about
I'll,
at the beginning
here,
of the
here's
show.
What I'll tell you. Here's what
that
I'll
movie's
you.
5 years old sitting in
it's
my pile.
It's a little better.
Here's the thing I'll tell you. You can tell the difference in directors and writers because the First Class had a lot more better dialogue with Fassbender and McAvoy.
Right.
How good's
that McAvoy, though?
Oh, he's fantastic.
How good
he's
is
very good
he?
Actor.
He's great. Yeah. Everyone's raving about Fassbender in this new X-Men. McAvoy's a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
He carries
You got to see Filth with McAvoy. That
I want
Scottish
to.
Film.
Yeah, I want to. It's
Lee,
on my
you'd
list.
Probably
love
that film.
Filth, yeah.
It's on my list.
Yeah, McAvoy is like a classic, you know, British Isles, you know, Scottish type actor.
More of a
psychosexual creep.
By the way, with 90 seconds to go before the show closes, I did want to say I noticed something, and we'll just make this really quick. Do you ever notice you eat less when you're around women?
Not really.
You don't? I don't do it on purpose. Is that conscious?
I do. Yeah, you're right.
It's that conscious.
Yeah.
I was at...
Even if it's women that know what a slob I am,
yeah,
I still
was
do
at,
it.
I was at brunch today, and this girl and I were at brunch, and this is the second time I went to brunch with her in 2 weeks, a little brunch date, and I'm like, I never finish my breakfast around her. When I'm at breakfast with Mikey and Len, I almost order second breakfast.
Lick the plate.
We get sides, we get extras. I don't know what it is. I never even think about it.
Well, maybe
it,
it's because you know you got to pay for her lunch.
I think so.
For her breakfast.
Well,
she tried paying today, too. I'm like, no, I got it. I'm like, I
we're such old fucking men.
Yeah, but I am like kind of.
Do you think they still do that? Hipsters still do that?
I don't know, but I should have let her pay. I'm like, I'm kind of broke. I just crashed Dad's car the other day. Blah,
you were
blah,
in
blah.
Your dad's car?
Yeah. Wasn't my fault, but I mean.
Did you rear-end somebody?
Long story short.
First of all, I can't talk about it on the air.
Wait, I got to listen to Allstate here.
Yeah, he's right.
We're going to go. I got to go tell this story, but I have a concussion, and that's the
grown
story.
Grown fucking
basically.
Man going to brunch.
Oh, I love brunch. We do it all the time.